Cork's number one talk show, The Opinion Line. With PJ Coogan on Cork's 96 FM.
I'm a little bit jealous that I'm no longer considered to be among the great and the good of this city. Or was I ever? I wouldn't have turned down an invitation to tuck in at the Crawford Art Gallery last night. Seems everybody and anybody who is somebody was there. Poor old Peach left on the sidelines. I'm not happy about that. I'm only messing, lads. God. 1850-715-996. Text us to 083-396-9696. Email the show opinion at 96fm.ie. It was a lively morning, and of course you couldn't have a royal visit to Cork without the royal fishmonger himself. It was a busy day, Pat. You got mentioned at the highest level. You got mentioned in the address. Good morning.
Did I, PJ? You did indeed.
Apparently, I think something about the food in the market was as good as your jokes.
That's not saying much for the food, PJ.
This is what worried me, Pat, to be honest. Obviously, he doesn't know you as well as we do.
Exactly.
A good day, though. A great day for the market.
A great day for Cork.
Yeah.
An absolutely great day for Cork. I think the market looks absolutely amazing. I think credit to the 48 traders or whatever in here. The quality of the food, the look of the stalls, just, you know, the bar was raised again and they delivered. And I think people got an incredible impression of Cork food, Cork hospitality, Cork welcomes and just pure Cork.
Yeah, it's a special place and it's a special buzz in there. And when it tarts itself up for an occasion like yesterday, it's global class, isn't it, Pat?
Global class. And I mean, for somebody like me, PJ, who's been in here through the bad times and the good times, you know, when you think 20-odd years ago they were talking about knocking the English market and putting a multi-story overhead, and it really was on its knees. I think we had 14 empty units in here that time. It was thirsty, it was shabby, it was careless. And you see the effort that has gone in by both City Council and the traders themselves, and the level they've brought it to. And there's more to come. I mean, you know, we're constantly looking at improving it. And I think there was a fantastic sense of pride among the traders yesterday that, you know, second royal visit in, what, 6-7 years? And they were absolutely, both them and their entourage, and the entourage is probably as important as they were, because there was huge international press there. To see that display of quality Irish food, just incredible.
What are they like, Pat? I mean, he came across certainly yesterday as a very affable gent. He was smiling and joking with people.
Well, I suppose circumstances of birth are different, PJ, but otherwise they're quite like you and me, I'm afraid. They just talk quite normally and they have a laugh quite normally and they're hugely engaging. I mean, he was fascinated that, you know, I could say yesterday that I had wild salmon that was caught 200 yards from the English market in the River Lee. That it was on display on our counter yesterday morning, and that he would be eating in the Trisville Arts College last night. And I said, you know, you just don't get more local than that. Family businesses, local produce, literally caught, you know, on the River Lee running through the city, and presented by world-class chefs like Rory O'Connell at the Crawford Art Gallery last night. And I say that with pride, PJ, I'll be honest about it, because, you know, that kind of presentation and that kind of cooking and that type of food can hold its own against anything in the world, anything or anywhere in the world. And that is a huge plus for Cork.
I sometimes think, you know, Pat, that when we say hold its own, I think we even do it a disservice. I think it stands above a lot of other places.
It's above most places, but as I said, it can hold its own against the best in the world. And, you know, I have no doubt in that, and I'm not just saying that. That is fact, and I think, you know, the meal that was put on there last night was just the finest of local.
I saw the menu; it was fabulous. Come here, are you arranging any visit from Meghan and Harry now? That'll be the next one.
It's the next one I'm to work on, really, in the future. Never know. Never say no, you know.
While I have you, Pat,
we won't spare the horses, as the fella said in train.
while I have you, we finished up yesterday, and I'm going to continue it this morning. People who met in the workplace, or however else they met before the days of Tinder and fish and all that kind of nonsense, First of all, are there any marriages and romances that you know of out of the English market over the years? And did you happen to meet your own missus in there?
No, I met my own missus in Garryvaugh in East Cork, and we still go there, so
yeah,
all good there. God, marriages, and I'm sure there were, but off the top of my head, Peter,
yeah,
can't think of any. But I'm sure there were.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were.
It's that kind of place, people working in there for decades on end, you know?
Yeah, although generally it's in competition rather than in romantic engagement.
This is probably true. Listen, go on. Go on. Mind yourself. Thanks a million.
Bye, PJ.
Cheers, Pat. Take care. Bye-bye. There you go. That's Pat O'Connell at the English Market. Madeline was invited last night. Hi, Madeline. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. How'd you get on last night?
Oh, it was wonderful. So we actually went to the daytime ceremony in City Hall. It was really, really wonderful. It was a great morning. The building looked beautiful and the company was great and Charles was in flying form and all the speeches were great. So we had a lovely time.
By all accounts, he took time and had even a brief moment to speak with anybody who wanted to talk to him.
Yeah, it was amazing. We were lucky enough to line up and be introduced, and he spent some time talking to us. We had been invited through the International Sustainability Unit that he runs, and we chatted about that. We chatted about his Derrynam beach clean that's planned today, I think, and we just talked very generally because sustainability is really close to his heart.
He's a big conservationist, isn't he?
Absolutely. He's considered one of the world's leading conservationists, actually. He's way ahead of his time. He was urging for action on global warming back in the 90s, and he even gave a speech on the nightmare of plastic waste just as recently as January of this year, at the British Academy in London. So he's completely ahead of his time.
Okay, and did you have any chance to exchange a few words with him about that, about the plastic?
Yes, we did, and we talked about Plastic Free Kinsale, and we talked about our new social enterprise that we've created called Change by Degrees that helps communities and businesses to become more sustainable. And, I mean, he's great that he gives time to people as he moved around the room because people were, really appreciative of that.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I see in the paper this morning or in the news that McDonald's in Ireland now are doing away with plastic straws. You'd be pleased with that.
We are delighted. The snowball effect is really hitting home, isn't it? It's just remarkable. So we were delighted to see that in the news today.
All right, Madeline, listen, good to talk to you. Thanks very much. That's Madeline from Plastic Free Kinsale. 1850-715-996. In studio next, the Lord Mayor of Cork. On the final day of his year in office, we do it every year. And this year's no exception. Tony Fitzgerald in studio next. 1850-715-996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM. Call The Opinion Line now. 1850-715-996. Cork's 96 FM.
It's long been a tradition that we talk to the outgoing Lord Mayor on the last day in office on the show. And no exception this year. Tony Fitzgerald, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, PJ. How are you today?
Good, and thanks for putting us into our schedule. I know you're busy. The Lady Mayoress is with you. I'll talk to Georgina in just a second. The daughters, forgive me, I've heard your daughters' names so many
Michelle
times, I've forgotten them now. They're over there. Hi, ladies. Good morning. Tony, we sat here this time last year and you were full of enthusiasm and full of excitement. Did the year deliver for you and your family?
It most certainly did, PJ. Yes, we had given it a lot of thought, I suppose, before we were expected to come into office. You know how the system goes, how a Lord Mayor is elected. And we decided, like coming from a youth and community background up in the north side of the city, in our home parish of Knockdaheeny, we decided that it would be a community, it would be a family, and we'd try to embrace all sectors of the city that we have engaged in that background. So we planned it out, and I worked one day a week with the project above in Knockdaheeny. Georgina, Lady Morris, worked 2 days and she took 3 days off. She was off Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. So, we planned it out and we said, look, we'd go to as many things as possible. We'd take what we came from, go from where we came from, and get out there in among the people, both locally, nationally, and internationally, because there's an international role for the Lord Mayor as well.
There was a lot of international travel for you this year. Did that sometimes take you out of the city at a time when you might have preferred to be here? For you were gone, for example, when Ophelia hit.
Yes. the international travel didn't come into play till after Christmas. We had, we have our twinning with Shanghai and San Francisco. And of course, I'm in the World Health Organization political group. So I had a role there in bringing all the mayors across the European Union together in Copenhagen, signing the Copenhagen Agreement on Healthy Cities, which we'll actually sign today, this afternoon in City Hall. But yeah, it does take the diary, it does soak up sections of the diary, but I think we planned it out quite well. We were able to make sure that that we were back home very quickly, and we were literally no sooner off the plane in Cork Airport, which is a fantastic place, and we were on the road with Finbar and into the next event. So it wasn't a case of coming home and going to bed. It was what's next when we arrived in Cork?
The office of the Lord Mayor, we hold it in Cork, I think, at a level of respect that's probably not reflected anywhere else, except maybe Dublin. But we certainly hold our office of Lord Mayor in very, very high esteem in Cork. Does that rest heavily on your shoulders as you take on sort of the mantle of McSweeney and McCurtain and all those guys?
Absolutely, PJ. The minute the chain rests on your shoulder, there's a huge honour, privilege and responsibility. Of course, I went to the North Mon, and Terence McSweeney, Tomás McCurtain, were Mon boys. And in fact, in 1920, PJ, we had three Lords Mayor. We actually had another man called Donald O'Callaghan, who was also a North Mon boy. And we placed a portrait of him in the Lord Mayor's office, because during the story now, in the recollection or in commemoration of the War of Independence from 1920, the burning of Cork and the deaths of two Lord Mayors will now come to the fore in the next 2 years. So I was keen to make sure that legacy was continued. But yes, everybody asked me about the chain. It's 960 grams, about the weight of a 2 pound bag of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And it has 52 links, and I produced a lovely bookmark on it. And it is an amazing experience, PJ. And of course, the connection, as you say, quite rightly say, the connection is with the people. Where did it all start? It started with Terence McSweeney. Terence McSweeney was also an educator, a poet and a writer. And he was the Lord Mayor who started the school visits.
Mm-hmm. How many did you do this year?
We did about 86. Right. And then in all the travels we went to, we also ensured that what we were doing at home, we did abroad. So we went to schools in Shanghai and New York and Boston, and we continued that legacy abroad.
And did they know when you go into a school in Boston or New York or Shanghai, did they know who this fella is in the chain standing at the top of the room?
They did, because we sent them, the detail of the significance of the role of the Lord Mayor in Cork, and they were actually blown away by it. In fact, in Belfast, a few short weeks ago, we did the same. We did exactly the same, and we went to two schools in Belfast, and, the teachers there were just in awe of what the Lord Mayor does in Cork. In fact, the outgoing Lord Mayor in Belfast, Nuala McAllister, said, if I had known, I would have continued such a programme. So I said, well, we're going back to 1920 with two great men who started this. But that's the connection, PJ. There's no question about that, because everybody remembers the Lord Mayor coming to the school, whatever generation you come from. Everybody remembers, of course, the half day, but now it's homework off for the pupils. And the amount of time and energy goes into the schools. You remember, they're just back after the summer holiday, and they need a little boost.
Yeah.
And next thing, the Lord Mayor comes, and the excitement, and that was just amazing.
It is still a very big day in all the schools. Now, in terms of the office itself, and as I said, the esteem in which it's held, that goes without saying. But it's kind of powerless, isn't it? There isn't a lot you can do. Would you like, or would you have liked, or do you think a future incumbent would like to have more power to make solid decisions policy-wise?
Yes, I think there is a question there to be answered. I'd have to say the demand on the diary, takes the Lord Mayor, he or she, out of the office a lot, because there is a civic engagement, there's a public engagement, and to have the role of, an executive role would be quite challenging. I'm convinced that it's very difficult to do, given the demands of the office. However, I think if you take the boundary extension, our chief executive, Anne Doherty, and the team did a very good job. But then their role was to come back to me as Lord Mayor, and then my role was to engage the elected members. Mm. And we did that very professionally. So every time that they met with the implementation group, then I engaged with them, with Anne Doherty and her team, and then I brought in the political leaders, the party leaders, and the CPG, the corporate policy group, and then we decided then to go to council and inform them, and then we made the decisions in terms of moving forward, and that process was quite delicate, quite challenging, because for me, I wanted to make sure that the profile of Cork remained at the status it was, and to increase that. Mm. It was difficult. Sometimes I did feel a little bit alone, because, you know, it does come back into the Lord Mayor's office where you have to take it to the next stage. But I'd have to say the partnership between the executive and the elected members was second to none. And I want to thank Anne Doherty and all our team for that. The other one, I suppose, was the city centre strategy. Again, you know, a decision has to be made. You know, we made a decision in council, it has to be implemented. And then it comes back to the political leaders in the city. And now we're working, we're looking at the strengths and weaknesses of what happened, and we'll move that forward.
Was it, and I had the chief executive in here with me one Friday in the middle of it all, was the PANA ban an embarrassing cock up, Tony?
I don't think so. Cork is going through a major change. You know, we're going through, you know, in my time, you know, we lived in two or three bedroom houses, you know, front and back gardens. The new generations coming want to use public transport. They want to live in the city centre. They want access to shops. They want to live locally in the city centre, you know, with the new foreign direct investment coming in. Navigation House in next February is going to have 3,000 people on the Docklands. You know, we have One Albert Quay. There is a continuation of planning applications coming in there. So we have a new urbanism coming in. So we have to be ready for that. So I'm very confident that with the core group that is there within the City Council, with the CBA, the Chamber, and all the partners, and the plan that's now in place to regenerate the City Centre moving strategy. Mm. But we all have a role to play in promoting that, and I think that's important.
Your successor will have to deal with it, I guess, when it comes back again, which, by the way, is in 55 days.
Yes.
Are there things happening?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. There are plans underway. We've nominated extra public representatives on the core group. I've attended the latest meeting. There's a communication strategy coming out. There's a promotion of the city. You know, our traders need to be looked after. And it's a role for all of us. And I think, you know, in fairness, it's a plan that has to be put in place. But we need to make sure everybody's together.
As you leave us as well, there is still no event centre.
There isn't. But I again, look, I walked out of Parky Kiev the day it opened and the night of the Ed Sheeran conference, and nobody asked what happened about all the planning of Parky Kiev. What a magnificent facility.
Yeah.
The vision of the Cork County Board there, incredible.
Yeah.
I'm
Will we get the centre?
Well, I think we will.
There's probably stuff you couldn't even tell me. But absolutely. Will we get this?
Well, what I have seen is the detailed attention that the chief executive and Pat Ledgewood are giving to the event centre. The Taoiseach, to be fair, Minister Coveney, I've met him on a number of occasions. He has briefed me on various aspects of it, and I've spoken to Tio Conlan. Their heads are working together to make sure it happens. And I'm confident it will, based on the information that they're giving me. But there are technicalities that need to be dealt with from a planning perspective. And there is also the accountability of public funds in terms of additional money. And we have to get that right.
Because it does
absolutely
give the impression of being a shambles.
Well, look, I think we have great artists here in Cork. We have great sporting people. I think when it gets the green light to go ahead, I think we'll all look back and say that was well worth it. But during my term of office, obviously it's not a role for the Lord Mayor because we're not involved in those decisions. But having been briefed by both the Chief Executive and the Taoiseach and talking to Tio Conlan, the work and the detail that's going into finalising this is extensive.
One of the highlights, I think, of your year was, and I'll bring the Lady Mayoress in again, Georgina, on this one, was you held a very special day to mark the rescue workers and the public service workers who gave above and beyond during the storms. That was important to you.
Yes, well, I suppose the Lord Mayor has the traditionally the Lord Mayor has the community and voluntary awards and the civic awards, and I felt it was important that we would acknowledge the emergency services that that looked after the people during those two storms. So we integrated it and we mixed it and involved it in that night. And they are amazing people. You know, Lady Morris will tell you, going around to the hospitals at Christmas, going to the fire service, going to the Garda Síochána, they are amazing. They go beyond the call of duty. And I just want to thank them for all their work. And I felt it was important that we would recognise that as part of a major community event in the City Hall. And of course, your own Derry O'Callaghan was a worthy recipient of that. And I think he's an amazing guy. And and I just want to thank him for all the work he has done here on a Sunday morning, because he does touch the lives of so many people here at 96 FM.
It's like a Sunday morning social club for the whole city. I want to bring you in at this stage, Georgina, because anyone who knows you for years knows that you're quiet, and the publicity of the Lord Mayor's office is not something that you took to easily. You like to stay behind, but with that chain around your neck, you can't. Have you enjoyed your year?
I have, PJ. Yeah, as you said, it did take me a while to get used to it. But, you know, every now and again, my two girls, Michelle and Deborah, gave me an old giving out to, I suppose. And I think I probably needed to hear that. And I think once I had my coffee morning over last September, that really gave me the confidence to be able to do what I've done. And, you know, just because we have the chains on us, it's really, we stayed true to who we are. Yeah. And we didn't stray from that. And, you know, and it was really all about the people.
Yeah.
And getting out and meeting the people. And, you know, I think we've done that. So I think I can be proud of myself. But it has been absolutely amazing, and people were fantastic.
I think himself is extremely proud of you, because he's spoken of you at many events. I think, Tony, it's been a little bit, and for both, it's been a little bit emotional too, because your dad isn't well and he wasn't able to go to a lot of things.
Yeah, dad is 87 and mum is 85. They're both amazing people, you know, and I wouldn't be here without them. And they're in good spirits, you know. They rise to the challenge every now and then. Mum is very busy up in the Senior Citizen Centre in Knocknaheeny. She was 85 last May. She got an iPad for her birthday, and it was her second or third one, I think. And she can go on Facebook and Google. What an amazing woman!
I think she might have led a sing song in the chamber.
That's right. Well able to do
she
that.
She has words to rebel songs I didn't know existed.
she's an amazing woman, and yeah, look, and of course, you know, my team this year was kind of the city of bridges, you know. So Mom was from Fairhill, a place called Washbrew Lane at the foot of Fairhill, and then Dad was from Turner's Cross. So, you know, we're a city of bridges. You've got to cross over the bridge to get to the north side, to the south side, or vice versa. And it's a significant feature of our city. But what's also built into that is the citizens' bridge, you know, the connection of the stories of people who met their husbands or wives and say, oh, I brought you over the bridge, over the Rockgate Bridge, and over the Southgate Bridge to Ballyfeehan or Gronabrohar or Farnry. And there's lovely stories, actually,
about
that.
You touched on a theme, actually, that we started yesterday and we'll be continuing during the morning. You both worked, didn't you, in the health service, but that's not where you met.
Yeah, well, Georgina just lived across the road from us in Knocknaheeny. I started work in the St. Finbar's Hospital in 1978 as an attendant there, and then moved over to the regional a couple of weeks later, and I brought in the first patient in 1978. So I was there until 1994, and then moved up to Knocknaheeny when we were starting to build the programs there and the services. And so I'm managing the youth centre there with an amazing team up there. Good morning, everybody up in the cafe. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely brilliant in the youth cafe there. And then Georgina started.
I worked in the North Infirmary. I started there in 1974, and I was there till it closed in 1987. So then I had 2 years or six, a couple of years out with the two girls after having the girls. So now I'm in the Mercy Hospital in the outpatients. So I'd like to say good morning to everybody in the outpatients and to the Mercy Hospital. So yeah, so we actually lived across the road from one another, PJ. So I didn't have to go far to meet him on a date. It was just look out the window and I could see him coming across the road. So,
and was there a spark there from, what were you, like, were you childhood sweethearts?
Yeah, absolutely. So,
and Georgina lived in Knocknaheeny when there wasn't any houses at all.
That's right, yeah.
When they came to live there. Yeah,
so we're there, we're in Knocknaheeny about 51 years.
Right.
So there was nothing but fields. And so we used to go over the wall at the orthopaedic.
And you emigrated to Knocknaheeny from where?
From Dublin Hill.
Oh, Dublin Hill.
Yeah, because my mum came from Dublin Hill and my dad came from Farnery. So we got the first house up in Knocknaheeny Avenue.
My goodness.
And so we've been there since. So my family home is still there. My four sisters are still there.
Yeah.
So so I'm one of 11.
Was Lady Mayoress ever in the life plan?
Never expected this to happen at all. But I must say, it's been amazing. So I think that's a big bucket list that we have done now, and you know, very proud to have represented the people of Cork City. So
I think you've both done. I introduced you. I had the pleasure and the honour of introducing you at many functions during the year, Tony. And I always said the same thing: you come across as a man who loves what he's doing, and you did, didn't you?
I did. I really loved it. I mean, it was amazing. Like, the body is tired, though, I'd have to say. Look, and again, you know, as I say, coming from youth and community, like, it's just being out there with the people. You know, we were in City Hall the other day, and you know, we had lots of groups in, and I said to them, does anybody want to sing a song, or does anybody say a poem, or do a dance? And then this man jumped up and got his feet right and danced around the crest in City Hall. What an amazing
only in Cork, as they say, pure Cork. Like,
yeah.
One thing that we always talk about, and we talk about many times, and I'll finish with this: the way we select our Lord Mayor. I mean, our incoming Lord Mayor, we know who it is. We'll be talking to him on Monday. We kind of can predict year in, year out who it's going to be. Maybe one day we would go into our ballot box on the day of a local election and get, as well as our local representatives, a second paper with maybe half a dozen names in it to elect a Lord Mayor for 5 years who would strong as executive powers. Is that an idea we should consider tonight?
Yeah, well, I think the time to reflect on the role of the Lord Mayor and how we can enhance it more deeply is probably at the end of the 5 year cycle. You know, City Council local elections are held every 5 years, so we have an election next year.
24th of May.
Yeah.
Right in the middle of radio's on. Thanks, yeah. Lads.
Well done on that too, an amazing project. Again, I made a decision on the freedom of the city. I said, look, I think we need to revisit this, and we need to see how we can honour people. Because this year, for me, has been a year of celebration of so many awards.
Yes.
And of course, given the gift of the Civic Awards, six honorees there, and then there's lots of examinations.
But is there more the office can do then, and with respect representing awards and representing us? Is there more the office could do if it was directly elected and had executive powers?
Well, I think that would be very challenging. I genuinely believe that, because again, remembering the amount of requests that come in to the Lord Mayor's office for people. Like, yesterday we were up in Fairhill at a launch of a community art programme in Bright Valley Park. They want you there for an hour and a half. Like, you know, we're going back up to the Fairfield this afternoon to open a gym, an outdoor gym. You know, that's where I grew up. You know, I spent my childhood with my grandfather over in the Fairfield. People want you. And then to try and get back to run the city, I'm not too sure. And when you get to all these, like, the recipients just love, you know, when the recipient is getting an award and their families and friends are there and the Lord Mayor is giving it to them.
It's
pure Cork.
What's this I'm hearing about you on a bike?
Well,
and Patrick's Hill.
Again, at the Northside Business Awards, I was at the event, and I met so many small enterprises, and this gentleman from City View Wheels came over to me. He says, I've got an electric bike here, he says, and I'd like it to launch it for me and get a bit of price. I said, no bother. So I sat up in the bike, and he said, would you would you promote with me in the city centre? I said, I would, of course, no problem. So he said, I'm going to take it up Patrick's Hill. And I said, well, I'd never cycle up Patrick's Hill. But he said, it's an electric bike. So in a few minutes, when we leave here, I'm heading over to Patrick's Hill and I'm going to sit on a bike and I'm going to cycle up to the top of it. And hopefully I'll get to the top of it. But so isn't that a pure innovation from people of Cork? Isn't it brilliant?
Well, there's congratulations coming in from all around. The Deputy County Mayor, Ian Doyle, has said congratulations to you both. Lots and lots of messages. Tom Berry, one of our regular listeners. Many, many more people just messaging both of you and your family for how well it's done, how well it has gone down for the year. You've done a superb job. Congratulations to you, Tony, to you, Georgina, and to Michelle and Deborah, because you've represented thank the you office so with distinction, I think.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody who supported our Christmas Carol concert and our charity ball, St. Patrick's Weekend, and our Golf Classic. There's so many people who came in and support us. And just to all the voluntary organisations, the Penny Dinners, the Simon, the Samaritans, what a wonderful people. People just giving so much. And again, on behalf of the Lady Mayoress, myself, Deborah and Michelle, thanks to all our family, thanks to all our friends, and thank you, Cork.
Go take a holiday.
Thank you so much.
Lord Mayor, Tony Fitzgerald, Lady Mayoress Georgina, and of course Michelle and Deborah, thanks for being with us today.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world. Cork's 96 FM. Everyone knows Cork's 96 FM plays the biggest hits. Hit. Music. But we also bring you the best variety on Cork's most listened to radio show. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. Oldies and Irish with Derry O'Callaghan. Sunday mornings from 10. It's a new dawn,
it's a new day. With Blackpool Shopping Centre and Retail Park. Sundays as they should be. Pure Cork.
Cork's 96 FM. This is The Opinion Line, Cork's number one talk show with PJ Coogan, Cork's 96 FM.
They're a lovely family. There's a lot of congratulations and handshaking going on. The studio KC came in as well. They're a very, very nice family, and they've been an excellent first family for our city for the last 12 months. Right, 1850-715-996, text 083-396-9696. The British Medical Association is now advising women that any alcohol during pregnancy might have a negative effect on the child. Elsewhere, there's also a new study claiming that eating for two during pregnancy, and find me a pregnant woman who hasn't had a massive appetite at some parts of her pregnancy, and the expression, ah, sure, she's eating for two now. Well, now there's a new study claiming that this could cause or contribute to childhood obesity, for God's sake. And for as long as anybody can remember, smoking when you're pregnant has been frowned upon and advised against. And it's led to a question posed in an article in the Spectator magazine. Well, are we allowed to have any fun at all now while we're pregnant? Are we women allowed to have any fun at all? And that article was written in the Spectator magazine by a writer called Ella Whelan. She's due to address an event as well in Dublin this weekend about whether mothers should have the right to smoke without being judged for it, even during pregnancy. She's a journalist and author, Ella Whelan, and she's on the phone. Hi, Ella. Good morning to you.
Morning. Hiya.
And thanks for taking our call today. The tone of the Spectator's article is, can't the BMA just admit it doesn't want us to have any fun? But surely, when you are pregnant, you shouldn't smoke. And if you drink at all, you should keep it to a minimum. For health reasons, yours and the baby's.
Yes, and this is what most women do. I mean, the idea that women want to be challenging the science, you know, no one's here to debate the science. The fact is that smoking and drinking to excess, certainly with smoking, is not good for you. Any kind of fool knows that smoking will eventually kill you if you do it enough, and the same with drinking. And so most women who are having children, who are pregnant, who are looking forward to
having a baby will want to give that baby the best start and will be doing all sorts of things to make sure that their pregnancy is healthy and eating right and not giving up bags and not drinking as much. But what we're talking about here is forcing women to do certain things. So many, many women will have the odd half pint occasionally. Actually, the odd half pint, again, is meant to be quite good for you because of the iron in it. Will kind of moderate their behaviour in a very sensible way.
Ella, could you ever get a little bit... could you get perhaps a little closer to your phone? It's slightly muffled there for me.
Is that any better?
That's a bit better now, yeah. Make your point there again.
No point, yeah. It's just that what I don't like is this assumption that women have to be told what to do. And the idea that we're all kind of going around, once we get pregnant, lighting up at, 20 a day and knocking back vodka Red Bulls. It's just not happening. And what we're in danger of saying is that women aren't individuals with freedoms and choice over their bodies, but that we just, once we become pregnant, we just kind of become incubators. We're like cattle that just are kind of producing the next set of livestock. Never mind about what we want, never mind about our own kind of sense of our sensible choices, we have to be forced to do certain things. And I think that's just very, very wrong.
In what way are you forced, though? I mean, you're advised, obviously. The British Medical Association there, for example, is arguing that you shouldn't drink. People would suggest you shouldn't smoke. Now they're I have doubts about this survey that says eating for two can cause childhood obesity. That sounds like a stretch even for me to believe. But are these not just sort of ways to keep you and baby as healthy as possible?
Nobody would turn away advice, and certainly from doctors, women get that have always got this kind of advice from their doctors while they're pregnant. So there's sort of no need for the British Medical Journal to come out and say this, because it's nothing that women don't already know. But the fact is, nobody is putting women in jail for having the odd cigarette or whatever, or having the odd drink. There are some states in America that do that. But the idea is that you have to kind of cajole women into living a certain way. And what that is saying is that once women get pregnant, they have no freedom to make their own decisions anymore. And it doesn't just happen in these areas. It also happens in relation to the pressure on women to breastfeed is incredible. And there's kind of been endless campaigns, certainly in the UK, about encouraging women to breastfeed up to 6 months, which means for anyone who has done it, basically not having a life for the first 6 months of your child's life.
Because but we also know that's better for baby, don't we? The evidence is there. That's better for baby too, isn't it?
Formula milk is just as good, actually, the science says. And the most important thing is for families to make the decision that's right for them. So you can imagine, take, for example, the smoking issue. If you have, I talk to midwives all the time in my work over in the UK, and they always say to me that if they take, for example, a mother who already has four children, who's working full time throughout her pregnancy, and who's got fairly kind of, hard life, and the thing at the end of the week that's just going to get her through that hellish week is one cigarette, one bit of time to herself. But it's immeasurably better for her and her well-being, her mental well-being, all of that, to do that, to let her have the freedom to do that, than to force her to not have that one pleasure. And that's about a sensible choice. That's not saying, oh yeah, go on and have packs and packs and packs and nothing's going to happen. That's saying people make sensible decisions about what is best for them. But I don't understand why that would stop the minute women get pregnant. We've just had in Ireland a campaign, fantastic campaign, that's won the right for women to have choice, to be trusted, to think about their own bodies and make decisions about their own bodies. Why is that different during pregnancy? You can't overstate the fact that it's just not a problem. We do not have women in vast numbers harming their babies, harming their fetuses through stupidity, through alcoholism.
There is a high level of fetal alcohol syndrome out there.
It's not, it's a problem with certain people, and it's a kind of issue that shouldn't be poo-pooed. But it is not a widespread kind of epidemic. We do not have widespread epidemics related to alcoholism. And in the same way that you kind of half laughed at the new study about the obesity, the links with obesity and eating for two, but I mean, this is what becomes the norm. It's like, it's the, can you imagine the pressure that's already on women who are about to become mothers? And then you add to that, if you don't breastfeed, then your child's going to be behind in school with some of the claims. If you eat too much during pregnancy, even though you're craving it like mad and it's driving you wild, then you're going to have an obese child. And if you, you know, the list is endless of the kind of stuff that women have to do. And the reality is, if you live a balanced and moderate life like most people do, you're going to have a happy and healthy baby. And the important thing is that you and your family are in a good situation as well. Okay. I just want people to lay off pregnant women. Just lay off and leave them alone, because it's kind of getting a bit authoritarian now, I think.
You'll be speaking at a conference or a dinner in Dublin under an interesting banner. The banner is, smoking is a feminist issue. What's that supposed to mean?
Well, it was last night, actually.
Okay.
And it was good fun, because what I was trying to do was take two things which you wouldn't normally put together and look at the history. There's a very interesting history of women rebels, but really in the early 1900s, certainly in America, taking up smoking in public places, as because it was a kind of a man's thing, to demand their, you know, their freedom, their equal place. And though it seems like a small thing, it was quite powerful. And, you know, New York State, city state in America banned it in 1908 because it was seen that women smoking was seen to be immoral and kind of a sign that you were a harlot and this kind of thing. So there's an interesting history of the rebelliousness of that linked with now what you have, which we've just been talking about, with whether it's anti-smoking campaigns, anti-drinking campaigns, get fit campaigns. There's this idea that people really have to toe a line and live a kind of very non-rebellious, very kind of boring, sanitized lives. And I was just trying to draw a comparison there and say, should we not try and champion this thing of freedom and choice that was there with some, they weren't feminists in the 1900s, so we didn't use that word, but women's liberation rebels, shall we say. How about a bit of that today? Yeah.
And would that include the smoking in pregnancy thing?
Well, it would be making that argument that about choice and about, you know, what I think what we forget now, and people kind of take it for granted, they hear, you know, there's studies being done now by Trinity College and the Irish Cancer Society about women and smoking, how to stop women smoking. And what they talk about is these kind of feminist things like, oh, you know, women smoke because they want to lose weight, or they smoke because it's, you know, they're more greatly affected by peer pressure than men. And all this kind of stuff, which is pretty insulting to women, in the same way that it's pretty insulting to say that we have to kind of almost pass legislation to stop pregnant women from smoking because we can't trust them to look after their pregnancies and their babies on their own. A little bit more trust in women and women's capabilities and women's intelligence, I think, is needed. And that's what I was trying to draw out in the talk.
All right, listen, Ella, good to talk to you. Thanks very much. That's Ella Whelan. Thanks, Ella. 1850-715-996. Her argument is, lay off pregnant women. They have enough to be putting up with. Don't be telling them they can't do this, and don't be telling them they can't do that. They know they can't drink to excess. They know they can't smoke to excess. And they know how to look after themselves and their unborn child. And stop coming down on them and telling them off. What do you think about that? What do you think about that? Katie, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, how are you?
Hey.
Yeah, wow. That was a lot in a couple of minutes there. And I don't even know where to get started.
We won't have a whole pile of time. I might bring you back after the news. But in general, do you think she's right? That women can make decisions for their own bodies and for their own health and don't need anyone coming down on them?
Ella has neatly sidestepped there by trying to say that smoking is a feminist issue and that we're being patronising and insulting and this, that and the other. Is that what smoking is primarily is an addiction, and what most people who smoke want to do is quit, but they can't because tobacco is one of the most addictive substances on this planet. And the idea that we need to stand up for smokers' rights above children's rights is just absolutely patently ridiculous. And the comparison with the Eighth Amendment referendum is so wrong, I don't even know where to get started with it. There's a very tenuous link there in terms of bodily autonomy. I'm very much pro-choice. I think that if a woman wants to end her pregnancy, she should be able to do so. But if a woman chooses to get pregnant and to remain pregnant, she is making a decision there to share her body. And at that point, you sign up to make sacrifices when you choose to get pregnant.
Well, what I might do, Katie, is take that point up with you from there after the news, because we are getting very close. I'll put you back onto there, Fergal, and we'll take that point up. Do you have responsibilities if you choose to remain pregnant? Do you have responsibilities to your baby, and do you have to take second place in that? There's a question we'll ask after the news.
Cork's number one talk show, The Opinion Line. With PJ Coogan on Cork's 96 FM.
I'll take up where I left off with Katie in just a sec, but I want to acknowledge the receipt of a lovely, lovely card in the post this morning. A card with a young man called Adam King on the front of it. And there's Adam King. It looks like y'all. It looks very like y'all. There he is in his special wheelchair, sitting on the strand and y'all on a sunny day, presumably very, very recently. And the card says, thank you for giving us a platform to tell Adam's story. It was very much appreciated. The new wheels have given him freedom and independence, and he's loving it. And that's from Fiona, David, Danny, Katie, Robert, and Adam King. We spoke to Fiona a couple of months ago on the show. That is so nice of you to do that, and thank you so much for that card. 1850 715996, text 083 396 96 96, and the email opinion at 96fm.ie. Talked before the news with Ella Whelan, who's a feminist author and journalist, and she effectively, now she was speaking, the dinner she spoke at last night was funded by Forest Éireann, which we've spoken to Forest on the programme before as well. They are a smokers' lobby, and that's what they do. They lobby for the rights of smokers to smoke. That's what they do, and she was speaking at that dinner last night, but she was talking about laying off pregnant women, particularly not just in regard to smoking, but in regard to drinking and eating and all the things. And Katie, before the news, was making the point that, well, look, when you make a choice to continue with your pregnancy, then you kind of enter a contract with baby. You say, I won't drink too much, I won't smoke too much, I will eat the right things, and I will avoid the right things, and I will make sure that you, the little baby inside me, has the best possible start that I can give you. Do you believe that that contract exists, Katie, in a kind of an unsigned thing, that that's the decision you make? You must put baby before yourself for that 9 months. Good morning again.
I don't think it's even a case of putting baby before yourself, because you're talking about doing things here that are good for you as well. Eating well doesn't harm you in favour of the baby. Eating well is good for you and the baby. You know, and I think Ella is doing something really clever there, actually, when she conflates, you know, eating and drinking a little bit, which most doctors would say, you know, one small glass of wine a week isn't going to do the baby any harm. So there's kind of, you can eat during pregnancy, you can drink in very moderate amounts during pregnancy. There is no safe level at which you can smoke during pregnancy, and that's a fact.
With regard to drink, though, like, you will find women who are pregnant, and there's a number of them in the building at the moment, shall we say, around us here. You know, she's not here today, but that's her, and there are others too. But they might like a drink, but they will, and talking to them, and not just Dee, they'll have their drink, they'll have their glass of wine at home in front of the telly. And the reason they'll have it at home in front of the telly is because if they were seen in their local with a glass of wine in front of them, the stares start.
I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. I'm sure it probably is. And yeah, maybe if someone's having one small glass of wine and they're getting judged, then that's something we should work on, because I don't think pregnant women should face huge judgment for every little scrutiny, for every little decision that they make. But just to go back to the point that we're really talking about here, which is smoking. I just want to reiterate, there is no safe level at which you can smoke. And any doctor will tell you that. So we can have a different conversation around drinking, and maybe we need to be a little less judgmental around a woman who decides to have one small glass of wine. But the real issue we're talking about here is smoking, and the idea that the right, and I'm inverted commas here, the right to have a cigarette during pregnancy, I think is absolutely trumped by the baby's right to health.
Because if you go up any given day, go up to CUMH and take a walk up towards the door. They're out, and I've said this before, they are in various stages of pregnancy with cigarettes in their mouths.
And what should happen there, rather than us tutting and judging and, you know, being horribly judgmental about it, is we have to understand that smoke, it's not a moral issue, it's a health issue. And instead of giving that judgment, we should be helping these women to try and quit smoking, which, again, I'll say, will be good for them as well as for the baby.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a moral issue, it's a health issue.
Well, as you said, and quite correctly, it's an addiction.
Exactly, and it should be treated as such. And with any addiction, you know, just looking at someone and going, geez, isn't that awful now, is never going to help. But if you say, as you say, these women are in CUMH, they're at a hospital where doctors can help them with that issue. And as a society, we can probably help by, you know, being a little bit more supportive rather than being judgmental.
You see, where do you draw the line? Are you supportive by saying, well, I understand now that you're addicted to the cigarettes and we'd love to think you could give them up? At what stage does that become, or does it ever become, listen, you're 6 months pregnant, cop on?
I mean, I think it's hard to say where that line is drawn. I mean, maybe certain people respond to the bit of tough love better than they respond to the, you're great now and we know you can do it. Maybe other people do respond better to, you know, you have responsibilities here and you need to be aware of them and you need to respond to them.
But in general, coming back to the smoking, you definitely think that smoking in pregnancy should be very, very actively discouraged.
Of course it should. Of course, smoking in general should be actively discouraged, and it is.
Yeah, but it's
the best
thing
Micheál Martin ever did was introduce the smoking ban, and it saved thousands and thousands of lives since then. That's the issue that Ella would like to skirt around, the idea that, you know, Ella didn't talk to us about, you know, do we think lung cancer is a feminist issue, you know?
She believes, look, if you want to smoke, you got a right to smoke. And that's Forrest Aaron's sort of mantra.
I've read the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and I didn't find the right to smoke there.
Yeah, I know. And I spoke to John Mallon from Forrest many, many times, and he makes that, you know, ironically, he no longer smokes. But anyway. All right, Katie, thank you. 1850-715-996. This is a thing that's come up from time to time on the programme. People observing that up outside, say, CUMH, if you go up there right now, there are women outside the foyer smoking. Clearly, obviously pregnant. And some of them in advanced pregnancy. Now, it's a smoke-free campus. You're not supposed to smoke anywhere on the CUH campus. But the funny thing, or the ironic thing, or whatever kind of a thing it is that you see, is if you go to the main door of the hospital, you'll see some people smoking. If you go to the main door of the emergency department, you'll see some people smoking. If you go up around the dental hospital, you'll see some people smoking. If you go to the consultant's suites, you'll see people smoking. But proportionally, the more people you see smoking are outside the CUMH, which is a very, very strange thing. Jerry's in Douglas with regard to, Jerry, do you think that when a woman is pregnant and she decides to keep that child and keep that pregnancy and carry it on, does she have a duty of care then? Must she put herself second?
She has a moral duty of care and health to herself and to the baby, absolutely. I mean, to say you have a moral duty to your baby or to yourself is absolutely ridiculous. To say that I have a right to smoke excessively, I have a right to drink excessively, I have a right to eat excessively and to hell with my baby is not an, it's an immoral attitude to have. You have certainly a moral duty of care to yourself, and you most certainly have a moral duty of care to the baby you're carrying.
Like, as Katie said, and she's right, if you eat properly and eat well, that serves both of you.
It does, of course.
If you reduce your intake of alcohol, if you reduce your intake of alcohol to a minimum, that serves both of you well.
It does. And you have a duty to do that, not just the rights. Duties come before rights. They're on and about rights. Like, I have a right to smoke excessively, and I have a right to drink, regardless of the effect it will have on myself or on my baby, is absolutely immoral. You have a moral duty of care to yourself, and you most certainly have a moral duty of care to your baby.
Okay. Gerry, thanks. 1850-715-996. Some of your messages on this one. Ruth says, by text 083-396-9696, has she ever heard a newborn baby, this is addressing herself to Ella, has she ever heard a newborn baby wailing in the hours and days after birth in nicotine withdrawal? I'll never forget that sound, as described to me by midwives in CUMH. I'm at work. And PJ, for God's sake, get that idiot woman off the air. This is from Anne. I'm sick of hearing about women doing what they want with their own bodies. They're carrying babies. They shouldn't smoke or drink. No wonder we have idiot kids with mothers who think they can do what they'd like when they're pregnant. And that's from Anne. Strong words, Anne. I'm sure we have idiot kids from that. 1850-715-996. On the royal visit, Dan in Ballinhassig said, during Queen Victoria's visit, thousands of people lined the streets of Dublin, and housing conditions at the time were worse than Calcutta. In 2018, we're just as bad. Nothing has changed. We've more homelessness than ever, and we have families living in hotels. And we also have figures now. With finally, what, in fairness to Thomas Gould, I think, of Sinn Féin, was saying this 3 years ago and more, that using electricity connections to count the number of houses being built is a crazy, crazy way of doing it, because it's wrong. But this morning, we finally have confirmation of that. It's amazing when it comes from another side of the room that we stand up and say, oh, that's very serious now. But when it was been said 3 years ago by the likes of Thomas Gould, go on, no, we have an issue. Anyway, 1850-715-996. Children in sport. Next. We hear from certain GAA clubs that young kids are starting to lose interest in sport and lose interest in being part of a football team or a hurling team because they mightn't be great at it, and maybe they can't hit snow off a rope, and they know they're not great at it, so they'll never be included. So they find themselves being the kid who's not picked. Or they might have, you know, they might be carrying a few pounds and they mightn't be as fast on their feet as the lad next door. So they get excluded and they get left to one side. And now they're abandoning GAA and sport. And does the organisation, and I guess other sporting groups too, like soccer and rugby, do they have an obligation then to make it a bit better, to make it just a little bit easier for kids, and to encourage kids to get involved and to do it even if you're crap at it? Pick up that hurley or put on those football boots and get out there and have fun. Is it time to look at that, particularly with obesity? Obesity is such a problem. And maybe some of the kids are putting on weight because they won't play hurling because they're not very good at it, or they won't kick a ball because they're not very good at it, or they won't run because they're not very fast. We should be encouraging them all to get involved. We'll discuss that for a little while. Are your kids involved in sport? Have you some of them who are very good, really natural, sporty people, and then others who plod along and aren't really that great at it? And if they pick up a hurley and run down the pitch, the worst they can do is no harm. Is it important to embrace that kid as much as you embrace the kid who's a natural? Because it's not happening. 1850-715-996. I'll talk to Rosemary next.
Text the opinion line now. 083-396-9696. Cork's 96 FM.
Can I just, before I go to Rosemary and before I continue with this sports thing, I want to wish a friend of the show, a young lady who's facing massive surgery today. Very, very best of luck. That's Holly Minahan. I spoke to Holly on the program a couple of times in the last few months. She has very severe scoliosis in her back, and she has been living in constant pain for many years. Well, she's going up today at the Blackrock Clinic in Dublin. She is possibly gone down now at this stage, so she won't hear it, but somebody will, and they'll tell her afterwards. She's facing a colossal piece of surgery today that will put it all right. Now, the road back will be long and hard and painful, but Holly will come through this operation, hopefully, with a beautiful straight back, and she'll be able to get on with her life, as any young person her age deserves to do. So to Holly and the Minahan family, from all of us here at The Opinion Line, the very, very best of luck. And I gave her on Facebook the other night my little motto, the little motto that I live by, and it's that everything will be okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. And a long, hard road ahead, but Holly, it'll all be great at the end of it all. Best of luck to Holly Minahan and her surgery today. 1850 715 996. Now, this all started at an Oireachtas committee in recent times, where the Fine Gael TD, Alan Farrell, was talking about a club in his own constituency which had changed its underage policy so that kids under 12 didn't actually compete. So they played, and they played for fun, but the games were not competitive. And it just, because if you get competitive, hundreds of kids are excluded because only the best of them would make the team. The kid who's a little bit slow, or the kid who isn't great with hand-eye coordination, the kid who's never going to be an inter-county footballer. They're gone before they're even 12 years of age. But in the club he was talking about, which he didn't name in the committee, there were no competitive games under the age of 12. And that's a policy that is being encouraged by a lot of people. Rosemary, good morning to you.
Good morning, PJ.
The GAA is losing young people. I know there's sports groups too, but they are losing young people because of the early competitiveness of it all, aren't they?
They are, and I was delighted, and that's what prompted me to ring. I was either going to ring or write, because I was delighted when I saw the headline. I'm going out later on collecting children from a hurling initiative in a local club with the school, and there must be probably 50% of the children that are there that have lifted a hurley. They're all, we'll say, I suppose, from junior infants up to second class age, and God help the teachers and the trainers, but they're all taking part, they're all having fun, and they're all feeling good about themselves because they're all getting a chance.
Yeah.
And it's so important.
At what age should competitiveness start, though?
Now, I know, but listen, I've had two children in start of the situation, and that's what I suppose I feel so strong about it. I mean, definitely maybe from under 14 upwards, things do get competitive. And listen, you have to step back as a parent. I don't have an issue then at that stage. I suppose they're older. They may still feel disappointed, but I think things do get serious from then on in. I mean, I suppose I had two children. They're not the star players. They still want to take part. They enjoy it. But I mean, I had one particular boy. He came off the pitch. He wasn't played for a full game. He was crying. He's not a crybaby. He wanted to give it up, he said. I mean, that would break your heart as a parent. But PJ, I said, I couldn't pull him out of it because sport is good. And when he wants to do it as such, it's good for his confidence.
Yeah. But if he's not great, if he's not very fast or not very accurate, or if he's maybe carrying a few pounds, which every small kid does these days,
I know, and it's not even
he's not
that.
Getting a game.
No, and listen, they need to. They still need to participate if they're training. They still need to participate. They need to feel good about themselves. I suppose it comes down to self-esteem as well, and their confidence.
Yeah.
You have some children.
If you're constantly left on the sideline while 15 of your friends are picked, you're going to stay there.
You're not, and you're not going to feel good about yourself. And I think, you know, there are some children, you know, they're lacking in confidence, they're lacking in self-esteem. They need that encouragement, and they need to feel good about themselves.
Mm.
You know, it is heartbreaking to see a child that's left sitting there, and sure, listen, they have feelings.
Yeah.
They have feelings. You know, it's very important. I mean, I was delighted when I saw that the Respect Initiative, I suppose, is being that it will be adhered to.
Yeah, because we constantly,
it's good.
We encourage our children to
we
take
do.
Up sport as a pastime.
We do, and fair enough, some children don't like sport, and I mean, obviously you can look for something else if they're interested, and there are other things there. But I mean, if they're interested, don't stop them, or you know, don't prevent them from doing it just because you don't play a child, or if a child isn't allowed to play, or you know, it's not fair on them.
Okay. Very good. All right,
it's not fair on them. I just like to close by saying, listen, just give every child who trains a fair chance. And I'm delighted now that the GAA are implementing their respect initiative. Fair. Well done.
Okay. All right, Rosemary, thank you. And great call, 1850-715-996. Now, one man who trains underage teams in his spare time, when he has some of it, is our good friend in Killarney, Stoke Kenmare, Paul Trevode. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, PJ. How are you?
Good. You coach and train young teams. We spoke before about this. The kid who couldn't hit snow off a rope, they do still deserve a run around, don't they?
Well, PJ, you know me well now, and I'm about to upset an entire nation because I would love to drive a 182 state-of-the-art 150 grand Mercedes, and I'm actually half contemplating in just crying because I think I deserve a chance to drive one. And that's what we're putting in now. That's what we're saying here about sport. They're saying up to under 14s, 15s that kids should get a chance. I'm going to frighten the hell out of you now, PJ, and all your listeners. They have now brought in elite sport in pretty much every sport for kids from under 13s and under 14s. So they're separating them even more. They're not just the guys who made the first team. We're taking the best of the best of all the first teams, and we're going to make them county players. And that's in Gaelic, it's in soccer, it's coming into rugby. So without a shadow of a doubt, but to put it on to the other side, on the kids' side, I took over my team, my son on it, because at under 11, he came to me at the end of the season, and he said, Dad, I'm not going to have a soccer team. Now, I call it soccer because in Kerry, obviously, religion is football. So I won't have a soccer team next year, Dad, he said, because we didn't win a single match. And any time we were about to win, the coach brought on all the other kids, and we ended up losing. And there was 8 or 9 players leaving the team for that reason only. So when I started and brought them into under 12s, I had a panel of 26 kids for a 9-a-side team. And every week I was getting guff off parents to say, oh, you don't play my Johnny, and why doesn't my Jimmy get a run? And I turned around and I said to all the parents, I tell you what, lads, there's a spare set of jerseys. Here's the directions to all the pitches. Coach a B team. There you go. Coach a B team, it's going to make my life easier and it'll make all the kids happier because everybody gets to play and not one single parent would step up to the plate.
But isn't 11 a bit too young for that, Paul?
No, absolutely. Well, that's why I took them over at under 12s, and under 12s, it's competitive. So now there's leagues, now there's cups, and I am 100% in favour that every single kid should be allowed to play the equal amount of time, get the exact same attention from the coaches up until it becomes competitive. But once it becomes competitive, well then, are you going to sacrifice the kid who isn't good enough, or are you going to sacrifice the kid who is good enough and is ultimately going to lose matches because of it? And I think that, like, to turn around to kids and say, look, just give out a little more and cry a little more and get mommy and daddy to come in and fight for you a little more, you'll get on the team. So I tell my players, and still to this day, and they're now going to under 14 next year, I tell my lads, I don't care if you're the most skillful soccer player in the world, and I don't care if you're the worst soccer player in the world. But what you will be is the kid who tries the most. That's my starting 11. So in training, you burst your ass to train and work hard, and you will get that starting position. And the results are that this season, I had probably 4 kids starting every match that didn't get a look in the season beforehand. Not based on ability, but because if you're the best soccer player in the world and you've got some mad lunatic running after you for the whole match, kicking the ankles off you, not giving you a second on the ball, trust me, it doesn't matter how good you are. So everyone has a role to play on the pitch, but they have to try hard. Now, I had a kid who turned around and he wasn't listening and he was messing. I said, off and do a lap. Just then come back in, and then once you've done your lap. So all of a sudden he comes back in doing the lap, and I notice him running around. I said, show me what's in your pockets. And he looks at me. I said, show me what's in your pockets. He took out a packet of sweets. Now, when his parents came to pick him up, I said, listen, your kid, and I don't care what you think of me, your kid is grossly overweight. Your kid has no interest in sport. Oh, and when I sent him off, well, PJ, look, sometimes you have to, you can blame the coach all you want, but sometimes you have to be realistic. Yeah, sometimes you have to just to be honest. And that's what I've always said about obesity. It's not a hidden illness. You can see it. And I said, the only people who care less about soccer than your kid are you, because the car has barely stopped by the time you've kicked your kid out of it to go training for an hour. I said, he was eating a packet of sweets when I sent him off to do a lap. And they laughed. They laughed at me and said, oh God, he wasn't doing that. And this is, these are the parents that are coming back to me and saying, look, Johnny deserves the same amount of gameplay as your centre forward or your centre midfield or whatever. It's nonsense. We have kids now that were getting to play at the start of the season that I haven't seen at training, that barely show up for matches. And when they do show up, parents are turning around saying, what's the story with my son? He's not getting to play. And I said, I'll tell you what the story with your son is. Do you know that he's on 52 levels higher than mine on Fortnite? And they're looking at me. And I said, yeah, because my son can tell me that, because he's playing at 4 or 6 hours every single night, probably when you're gone to bed, your kid's downstairs, and he has no interest, no energy, and doesn't want to come. But blame me all you want. It's all my fault. That's no problem. But this is what's going on. So at some stage, parents have to accept responsibility. And every single parent should get involved in their kids'
Paul,
sport.
But Paul, if parents are starting to walk away from sport, or sorry, kids are starting to walk away from sport and walk away from taking part in things like this, that's only going to add to the obesity problem, isn't it? So maybe we should be encouraging them all to get involved.
Well, I'm 100% with you on that. I think it's ultimately it's down to the parent to show the interest in the kid. And every single parent should get involved. If their kid is playing soccer, basketball or whatever, I don't care if you don't know the rules or the laws of rugby. Come down to your coach and say, look, do you know what? Leave the jerseys in the bag there at the end of the session. I'll wash them and I'll have them ready for you tomorrow or for next week. Or leave the bottles of water, I'll fill them, and I'll have them there for you next. Show some sort of an interest in your kid. That's where the first thing comes in. The second thing in is every single coach should try and develop, that's our obligation, that's our duty, should try and develop every single kid as much as that kid can aspire to be. That's why we're coaches. But then thirdly, and the most important thing, is when it becomes competitive, well then your obligation is to try and do well for your team. So you hear the top coaches, no team is bigger, or no player is bigger than any team. So if Ronaldo threw a hissy fit, I guarantee you they drop him, because they turn around and say, look, Ronaldo, forget about it, buddy. It's all about the team. So you have to try and do the best for your team. And if clubs have huge, I see here my son plays Gaelic, there's about 50 on his team, but they have about 10 or 12 parents and coaches. Now, all the qualified coaches, and let's just say, inverted commas, better coaches take the A team, but all the parents chip in and coach the B team, and everybody plays. And that's fine. And you need to tell the B team to say, look, lads, bust your ass here on this game, and you'll be over there next week.
Okay.
And hold develop on. Them and give them the chance.
Hold on, Paul, because Pat has been listening. Pat, you train a couple of teams as well, do you? Good morning. Hello, Pat? Oh, beg your pardon, he's on 5. All right, put that one back there and press this one here. Pat, you train a few teams, do you?
I do, PJ, yeah. Sorry, can you hear me?
You can, yeah. And you're listening to Paul.
I can't get over the idea that there should be such competitiveness at 11 or 12 years of age. I just think, and you know, telling young fellas that, you know, giving out about parents and stuff, I think we're way too competitive at 11 and 12. I was at a match last night now with both sets of parents, and it was an under 11 Gaelic football match, and I just found it incredible the amount of shouting and roaring that was going on. I'm not going to name the club now or anything, but yeah. I just found it incredible, and it was kind of a win-all situation for 11-year-olds, and I coach 11-year-olds in a different sport myself, and I don't have that philosophy whatsoever. I just think that everyone should get equal time. Forget about the result. I don't even think that there should be a result in these games, even up as far as 12. We're talking about young kids, 11, 12 years of age, going into school the next day, asking each other, how did you get on last night in your game? Or, you know, I didn't do so well, I only got 5-10 minutes of the game, we lost the game. They shouldn't even know the score of the game. I mean, there was about 40 scores in the game that I was at last night. They were all fantastic, but it shouldn't have been recorded.
Paul, your thoughts on that?
Well, you see, unfortunately, when it comes to that, and I agree with Kevin, I agree with Pat up until under 11s, 100%. But on the flip side of it, when it comes
to... You're talking about for me, PJ, sorry.
I'm going to put you back on hold so you'll be hearing better. Hold on there. Okay. Okay, Paul, go ahead.
When it comes that it's irrelevant as to what the coaches think, it's the kids. Kids aren't stupid. I see them at under 6 and under 7. What's the score, Dad? was the score at the end of that? I might be the first person to say, look, don't worry about that, you played well. But it's not me and it's not the coach. It's the FAI, it's the GAA, it's the Munster Rugbys, it's the Leinster Rugbys that have competitiveness coming in at 12. And in my opinion, I know it doesn't go with everybody's opinion, but in my opinion, it's a good thing. Because that's why we have Katie Taylors. That's why we have Johnny Sexton. That's why we have some of the world's best sports people competing at that level. Because we bring competition in. And it is a good thing. And kids need to be told, you know what, lads? I know the way we wrap you in cotton wool every day, but guess what? If you want to achieve something, you're going to have to work damn hard at it. It's not just going to come into your hands because you cried or that I went and gave out to the coach. Because as I said to the club when they brought me up, I said, Paul, here's a surprise. We've had a complaint. I said, go on. They said, you're not giving little Johnny a run. I said, if I turn around and bowed into that, and this is a parent who never showed up, but if I bowed into that, next week they'd say, look, little Johnny doesn't want to play left full. He actually wants to play striker because he loves scoring goals. So if you don't play little Johnny up front, I'm going to be given out about you too. So where does it stop?
Yeah, Pat, any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I mean, there's always going to be competitiveness. In a lot of sports now, I'm seeing a lot of these elite squads, and I think they're an absolute disaster.
Because you have
the best kids from each club going to these elite squads, and they're being built up to think that they're something unbelievable, you know?
But then again, as Paul says, Pat, isn't that where we find the Katie Taylors, the Johnny Sextons, the Ron Nogaras, the Pat Horgans? Isn't that where we find them?
It is, PJ, but what's the big picture here? Are we looking to win everything? Are we looking to have a healthier society, better mental health for our children? I mean, if you look at any GAA club, any soccer club in Cork, I'm in West Cork myself, right? You have the best going to these elite West Cork training sessions, Carbery training sessions, and you have the guys left over. And you have the guys left over who are basically training their own now because there's so much training time put into the fellas and the elite squads that they haven't time to train for their own clubs. They're coming back into their clubs with their lovely gear that they got for playing on the regional team. And the other fellas are kind of feeling like, do you know what, I think I'll give this up because I'm not making my regional team.
But doesn't it encourage those guys, maybe Paul you'd agree with me here, doesn't it encourage those guys to try harder and work more?
Well, I do, my own young fellow, the regional team and one of the other guys, and I make sure that I say, look lads, first of all, don't brag about it because next season you could be dropped. I said, but second of all, you're now ambassadors for our team and for our club to show that, you know what, a bit of hard work and a bit of skill and a bit of drive, more importantly the drive, will make you get there. But my problem with elite sports now is that now the sports are competing against each other to be elite, and this is the problem. So the GAA, and no offence to the GAA are now bringing it in at under 14 because the soccer, the FAI are bringing it in under 14. Munster Rugby, Leinster Rugby, the IRFU are bringing it in at under 14 and under 15. And Tomás O'Shea wrote a fantastic article there last weekend about becoming an elite sports kid, and you can't basically do the fundamentals of passing a ball from your foot to one of your other players. So we're making these guys elite, and now all these sports are bringing in 200 kids and telling them all they're going to be professional soccer players, county footballers, all this kind of, just to keep the kids away from the other sport. And the GAA, or the FAI, or the IRFU, they're now all telling these kids, here's what you're going to have to do at 14, lads. You're going to have to pick your sport, because if you're going to play Gaelic, you're off the soccer team, or you're off the rugby team, and that is absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
I think, Pat, you'd probably agree with him a lot there on that one. I think you're coming from the same page there. Pat, I'll let you go. Paul, I'm going to let you go in about 20 seconds, but I want you to tell me, first of all, Amazon Prime, you big devil, yeah. Amazon Prime, go ahead.
Amazon Prime. Well, I tell you what, PJ, I announced on my social media platforms there last week that I've just signed a huge deal with Amazon Prime with my Trevo travel show that's going into almost 200 million homes worldwide, but most importantly, about 90 million into the US alone. And it was a major coup, and you know me, I can't keep my mouth shut, but I've known about it for the last 3 months, but we basically went live last week. So it's in the UK, it's in Canada, it's in the US, and would you believe, the biggest streaming nation in the world, apparently, also into India. So any of your listeners...
And it's running already, is it?
It is, yeah, and it's getting some reaction. I can't believe the reaction. I'm getting tweets from all around the States and the UK and Canada to say, we just stumbled across this show, and holy crap, where did you come out of? And it's, you know me, it's a bit nuts, it's exciting, and it's cooking on the side of cliffs and on the top of mountains and all that kind of stuff.
And it's a bit of payback for the ones who didn't want to know, isn't it?
Well, you know what springs to mind is the likes of Mrs. Brown's boys and Father Ted. And hopefully one day our national channels will turn around and say, you know what, if the biggest streaming platform in the world has picked up on this guy, well, maybe we should actually be showing him in our own country. Because nothing would make me happier than to have my shows so that every Irish person can see it. But anybody who's listening, PJ, who knows an American, who's got anybody living in the States, friends, families, or the UK or Canada or India, tell them to put in Trevo Travels on Amazon Prime and to watch it, because that will boost the ratings a mile on Amazon Prime.
Go on, you do.
I'll finish on a plug.
I'm delighted for you, Paul. Thanks very much, Paul Trevo, Trevo's Restaurant in Killarney. And he trains football teams on the side. Take a break. David and John, you're up next. 1850-715-996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world.
Cork's 96 FM. Call the Opinion Line now. 1850-715-996. Cork's 96 FM.
So what age should children who play sport start being competitive is the one thing. And how do you keep kids who maybe aren't that good at it in it for their own health? And when does it come? When comes the time that the child is told, well, you know, Shawnee, you're really not good enough for this team. You're not playing very well, but you need to go and train with the other boys. When does that time come? David in Ballincollig and John in Mayfield. I bring you both in, guys. David, with you first. Do we have to paint a line or draw a line in the sand as to when kids have to learn about competitiveness?
I think you do. I think certainly for the GAA, I coach GAA, I coach rugby. I just find that you know, they're a lot of them are in training from like 4 to 5, maybe twice a week through winter, through summer. By the time they're 11 or 12, they're really quite skillful, I suppose. And it just invariably does get very competitive as they're kind of physically stronger and they're kind of growing bigger, you know?
Should we encourage that or not?
Well, this is what's happening and it's great. Like my you know, we are doing sports probably every day of the week, really, with our two. My daughter's played 2 matches already this week. She's had 3 training sessions. We've tagged rugby out in Ballincollig rugby club tonight. You know, so they just have it. They have the bug. They love it. You know, they're 9 and 7. And, you know, for everybody, for the whole family, it's brilliant. Like, I've met loads of friends myself through it. So it's just kind of a healthy lifestyle. But it does get competitive. And, you know, I see both sides of the story. You know, my daughter is probably someone who, you know, probably could go on and play for the club senior. And, you know, she's a very, very good player, you know. And then my son then, you know, he's 7 and, you know, he's not the biggest fella. Or, you know, no more than I was an amazing hurler. Do you know what I mean? But
at 7, you know, at 7, David, is streaming right for him?
They are streaming, yes. Now, to
is
a
that
certain
right
extent,
at 7?
Well, listen, some boys are more skilled. Like some guys, some 7-year-olds on our team that we see are just unbelievable. They're hitting a ball that I couldn't hit when I was 12. And, you know, you get them playing together, they make each other better. Now, in fairness, with the Go games, and the coaches are very good, I find, that they'll put 2 or 3 of those boys into, say we go visit a club, they'll put 2 or 3 of those boys into a team, and then they'll put the other boys in. So there's kind of a mixture in each team. There's no like A team at age 7 or anything like that. So that really will be the Go games, the GAA Go games are up until age 11, and then it gets into kind of leagues and kind of keeping scores then after that, you know?
Yeah, because as Paul said, this idea that you have loads of scores, but the score isn't kept record of.
They will come up
and ask you, what was the score?
Oh, they will, and we tell them they won, and, you know, we kind of say, oh, that was a draw, or, you know, we're not, there's no kind of big
thing about
it.
They're not stupid, they'll know.
They'll know themselves, and listen, we've often kind of, you see, our teams, certainly with Camogie, we train them all winter, so we find that come February, when the other teams are kind of starting up, we might go out and absolutely destroy the first team we meet or the second team, because they're just have to kind of coming together. You know, we've been kind of going all winter. So we'll kind of engineer our team then. We'll kind of put, you know, the good players in goals or put them in backs. And, you know, just to, you know, we don't want to see any child humiliated. Yeah. Just have fun, enjoy it, you know.
Yeah, and you worry about the competitive stuff a little bit later on. John's in Mayfield, stay there, David. John, you trained the team as well? Morning,
Jim. Well, I'm going back years now. I'm a bit on the tooth, but no, PJ, I'll tell you the truth, but I'm back to my time in the 1991 up here in Mayfield.
Get a bit closer to the phone, John, if you can.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Back up here in Mayfield in 91, on that way, we used to have street leagues.
Yes.
And because all the communities involved around Silver Heights, Lothamore, Liffey Park, Reader Avenue, and we used to get the children there to get involved, right, with the street leagues. And it was fantastic fun. Honestly,
yes.
That's what it's all about to me. It's fun. It's not about looking out for someone there, do you see, he's going to make there, you go.
But you might well see him or her there.
That's all money. Well, possibility there, like, well, unfortunately, it was just the boys we were doing, we were playing at that time, you know, with the children, from tiny tots up to 14 or 15. Yeah. And it was great fun to be had by all.
But now, didn't Roy Keane start in a street league back in the
day? You're right there. In fact, he never liked the game. He was encouraged to come off the line and go out and play. He was just to participate.
Yeah.
He never liked it, but there you go. It just goes to show. He was encouraged. That's the word I was going to look for
yes.
here. You encourage the children. You don't tell them. Because you tell them, they think you're dominating them, and they'll get frightened, and then they'll back off, and they won't bother playing no more.
Yeah.
Because they'll be scared of a person saying, hey, you must kick the ball that way, that way. He used to come over to me on the sideline, and the coaches, and say, can I have a game, Mr. Duffy? That was my nickname, I tell you the truth. All right? And I'd say, look, can you kick a ball? I can. Just hang on there. About 3 or 4 minutes after, I take off one little fella and I say, you go on there now and you play. And he'd be out there and he'd enjoy himself. That's what it was all about to me and the coaches that we had up here.
Mm.
Not about money.
But was it about winning games, John?
Well, to me, everyone is a winner. We used to give them all at the end of the season or at the end of the street games. Everybody gets a medal. Win, lose, or draw, and that would make them feel good.
No. There is a thing.
That's what the enjoyment is about.
There's a thing about that, and maybe you want to come in on this, David, as well. And this is a thought. That's brilliant when kids are 8, 9, and 10, and everyone gets a medal for taking part and for being. But life isn't like that. Life is hard, and life is competitive. And if maybe is the sports field, and I know I've discussed this with Paul Giraud in the past, is the sports field a place that maybe we can start giving the odd lesson? That life is tough, and sometimes you need to be. Sometimes people are better than some people are better than others.
It absolutely is. Listen, at the end of the day, there's going to be senior football championships, senior hurling championships, and only one team is going to win that in Cork, out of all the teams that are in these leagues. So, you know, does that mean they've all had desperate seasons, or you know, they all haven't been successful? You know, of course not. You know, you kind of grade yourself. You kind of go, listen, you know, we won 5, we lost 3. You know, you're a great bunch of girls, and off we go again, you know. So I think, I don't think people are kind of unrealistic or, you know, we got beaten by a team last week in football, and, you know, it was the girls' third game of the day. And, you know, so what? They won 2 games, they enjoyed themselves, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't make a big deal about it. They kind of knew themselves. They were kind of happy enough. And, you know, they're fit and healthy going home. Happy days.
Absolutely. All right, I'll leave you both there. David in Ballincollig and John in Mayfield. Thanks, lads.
Cork's number one talk show. The Opinion Line. With PJ Coogan on Cork's 96 FM.
Into the final hour of the week, and as always, far more to do than the time we have to do it. But I want to give you a bit of a laugh for about exactly a minute and a quarter in a second. Some comments on the GAA and sport in general, not just the GAA. What age should it get competitive, and is competitiveness driving kids out of sport, and should we look more at encouraging them to play, even if they're playing rubbish, then just not get involved at all. On what Paul Trevaud was saying, Tom Barry says Paul loves the sound of his own voice. His attitude drives kids out of sport to take up God knows what, and also too much responsibility on their backs. Well, not really, Tom. All he's saying, look, you mightn't be very good enough for the A team, but, well, maybe your parents will get the B team together. You know, and sometimes there are hard decisions to be made. I read something recently, says Kevin, about how Iceland turned itself into a football powerhouse. They invested in getting as many people as possible playing in a structure. Now they're qualifying for World Cups. They were a laughing stock, but they did it by volume and by getting everybody involved. Caller says, with regards to the GAA, my son was hopeless at sport and used to play it just to be in with the boys. Because he wasn't great at it, he got bullied and was left on the bench. And he could feel that he wasn't wanted. I think now maybe it wasn't the best idea to keep him involved. His self-esteem suffered in the end. I just wanted to give another point of view on it. And there is always the risk that the kid who isn't great will end up getting bullied, which could be a problem. 1 minute of this to finish the whole GAA thing, though. This is class, and just 1 minute. Do you remember this? Do you remember this from Dunbelievable? This is the legendary Timmy Ryan. Timmy Ryan, the GAA coach. Do you remember this one? Hey,
hey. Am I tired? I know the fellas down there. And they're looking up here at me, and I know what they're thinking. I know what they're thinking. I know what they're thinking. What they're saying, what Timmy Ryan? What Timmy Ryan? Timmy Ryan is too hard on us. Well, I tell you something, lads, I'm not. You know all about it next year when you're playing under 14, right? Go out there today with a bit of fight, a bit of spirit, lads. Go out there today with a bit of pride of wearing the blue and green of Glengowrie on your back, lads. Think of that, lads. Go out there today, lads, and wear off them. Don't be afraid to break hull, lads. There's plenty on the sideline, right? Let every blow be a funeral. I don't want to see you coming back in here with dirty jerseys. I want to see you coming back in here with bloodstained jerseys, lads. And go out there today, lads, and enjoy yourselves, right?
And as he used to say at the end of every show, they're out there, and they are. 1850-715-996. Now, Peter Thompson, Dee met Peter's son in Middleton, was it last weekend or so, and there's a skate park, there's a campaign on for a skate park in Middleton or Carrigtwohill. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning, PJ.
Hi, I was only driving through Carrigaline last night, and I see they have a skate park gone up now. Where do they want to put the one in East Cork?
So, well, we're really at the very embryonic stages, PJ, of setting it up, but we're kind of thinking the most obvious location would be Middleton or Carrigaline. I suppose it's quite central in East Cork, and it's a badly needed amenity in East Cork, particularly with the huge growth in population over the last number of years. So we're mad keen to get something going.
The trouble with skate parks, and I'm only going to put this out there, is people look upon them as, well, they'll draw drugs and they'll draw antisocial behaviour.
Yeah. I know that's the sort of the comment we hear a lot. And I suppose part of creating a skate park is to debunk that myth. You know, I think there's a lot more to skating than that. And I think what we'd very much like to see would be that it would be in a very central location. I think you are at risk maybe of creating some of those things that you mentioned there, if you're kind of having it hidden away, you know, out of the sort of centre of the town. So we'd like to have it really central, so it's visible, and so we can have people see skaters for who they really are, and sort of debunk some of those stereotypes, you know.
Okay. It was Samson, I think, that Deirdre met, was it?
It was Samson, flying around on the skateboard in the Middleton Farmers Market, yeah, collecting signatures. We're trying to get a petition going, so yeah, he's standing right beside me.
Put me onto him there for a second.
I will, yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Hi, Samson. You're 12, are you?
I'm 13.
13, okay. And yeah. Skating, you want a park to skate in?
Yeah, I've probably been skating since I was about three, and I'd probably be twice as good as I am now if I had somewhere to skate, because I kind of live in the countryside, and it's about 5 minutes to Carrigaline, 15 minutes to Middleton.
Yeah.
So it would be good if, like, I could skate in close to home, yeah.
And I see people, a lot of young people these days, skating along footpaths on their way to school or wherever they might be going.
Yeah.
It is a very healthy and handy way to go around, but it looks terrible hard.
Yeah, it's quite challenging the first few months, or sometimes if you don't do it every day. But if you get at it every day for about, you could like start to know the basics within 6 months, and it's a really good way to get around, and it's just a very new opportunity for sports, because other children might not enjoy ball sports, yeah, such as GAA, soccer, rugby, so that type of sports.
And would that be you? Would that describe you?
Not totally. Yeah. But I like both.
You like to both. And what kind of things do you do in a skate park? I mean, is it tricks? Is it all stunt riding, or is it just a place to be with the other mates that skate around, and everyone's comfortable with each other's company?
It's really both. Like, you can, it's a great way to improve your talent, balance, and things like that. And it's just a great way to hang out with your friends. And there's also a risk.
Yes.
The adrenaline, yeah.
Now, you're trying to campaign and get support, and you were out gathering signatures in the farmers market. Is there a lot of support?
Yeah. Probably 90% of the people signed, and then, yeah, so...
And who are you going to give that petition to then, Samson?
We give it to lots of people so that they can sign it, and then we're going to hand it up to the council so that they know that a lot of people are
interested
in the skate park, so that they want to... Okay.
The line is terrible. Well done to you, young man, and well done to your dad for supporting a young, bright, articulate young lad. And get your petition together and give it to the council and see will they give you a skate park in Middleton or in Carrigtwohill. Well done, Samson Thompson and Peter, his dad. There is one. I just happened to be driving in Carrigaline last night, and I spotted one down in the community park there. Now, I'd be afraid of my living life to go anywhere near it, even on foot, let alone on wheels. But it looks like a crazy place for people to meet and to play. And we had the thing, remember years ago, we had one of those opened, was up the Mardyke somewhere, or the people used to go skating up there. And of course, you get the inevitable calls, oh, there's drugs up there, PJ, and all the antisocial behaviour up there. Maybe there is, but there's also kids who want a place to go and skate and do something active. And weren't we just talking about kids being active? And if they want to be active, kicking a ball or pucking a hurley or whatever, fine. But if they want to be active skating, then we should maybe give them a place to go and skate. 1850 715 996. We talked yesterday towards the end of the programme about, first of all, about Netflix and how it had changed its rules for staff on their film crews. And it would be flirting in the workplace is out the gap at Netflix because of these new rules. And it kind of led us to a different conversation as to, well, does anybody meet their partner in work anymore? Or where do you meet your partner? Because nowadays it all seems to be on flipping Tinder and plenty of fish and any other number of things that you can find on a smartphone. But does anybody meet their partner anymore in work? Or does anybody meet them anymore when they serve you a pint in the local? Or does anybody meet them anymore when they clean your car, or you're working next to them in a shop, or they, I don't know, purely by accident? And I promise, if you tell me your story about how you met, I'll tell you my story about how you met the Queen Bee. We've had about 5 marriages out of 96FM in the last 20 or 30 years, not including mine, by the way, not including mine. So where did you leave? Where did you meet your partner? Was it unusual? Was it strange? The funnier and the madder, the better. 1850 715 996. And depending on whether I get a good story or two, I'll tell you mine. All right, well, have some fun with that to finish out on Friday.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world.
Cork's 96FM. This is The Opinion Line, Cork's number one talk show, 96FM.
So the whole Netflix rules and regulations discussion led us down the road of, does anybody meet their partner in an ordinary way anymore? Or in an extraordinary way, if you like. I was talking to the Lord Mayor and Lady Mayoress this morning here in studio with me. They grew up across the road from one another, so kind of a natural thing. And a few calls yesterday, one person met her husband in, or her now husband, in a nightclub. They were working together and they had a snaky schnog at a staff party, and then he didn't look at her for about a year and went off and went out with somebody else, and next thing you know, they're together the last 20 years. 1850 715 996. Now, Chrissy, how did you meet your partner?
I met him through work.
Right.
But by sheer accident. I was working as a receptionist, and he had come over from Scotland, and he was implementing new processes and things as an engineer in where I work. Mm. And he frequently went out with his friends. There was a team of them that came over. So we met over Salpadine, really.
Salpadine?
Yeah. Because quite often they would have a hangover. So feeling sorry for them, I would give them Salpadine.
Those were in the days when you could get it without people looking at you as if you wanted cocaine. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah, Salpadine and a smile. I mean, I did think he was really cute and things, but because he was from Scotland, I didn't think there was much future in it, really. And then he was offered a full-time job. So he stayed. So once it got a few legs onto it then, and he was able to stay, it became more than just a smile, and he did ask me out when he knew that there was a possibility of a future in it, you know.
Yeah.
So, so 15 years later, yeah.
You met over Salpadine.
Yeah.
I think that's the best line ever.
He laughs about it, and he thinks it's probably a little bit more than that, but yeah, that was the first kind of, you know, you'd feel sorry for them when they come in, and, you know, they'd be trying to sign their visitor's badges, and you'd say, oh God, you were obviously pulled a late one. So, and from there then, you know, that was a conversation opener, and yeah, it just developed from there then, really.
I wonder how many more, was it the receptionist where you said?
Yes, I was.
Imagine
how
many more receptionists have a snaky stash of Salpadine in the drawer.
Well, not any longer. I mean, acting a chemist for us now is like, you know, you've committed a huge offence now, Salpadine. But
it's true. All right, Chrissy, that's a nice one. That's a nice one. She met her husband. What's his name, by the way?
His name is Davy.
Davy. They met over Salpadine. How cute is that? 1850 715 996. Like I say, in the time when you could have it in the drawer and you wouldn't be facing a visit from the narcotics division. Marie or Mary? Always have to ask.
Marie.
This was a nice one. You joined the job on the same day.
We did. The 3rd of July 2001, we joined the Irish Naval Services recruits.
Oh.
Didn't know each other, obviously. And as time went on, we just developed a friendship. And by the time we passed out in November, we were together.
Right.
And we're together 17 years now in October, and we're married 10.
Very good, very good.
Yeah.
And was it kind of instant? Did you, like, obviously you signed up and you were assigned to a vessel and all that kind of thing, or you went through basic training? Did you meet in basic training or where?
In basic training, in recruits. He was, Chris is from a long line of the Defence Forces, the Scots. There's a big amount of them in the Defence Forces. So he was kind of fairly well known. I was this little girl from Dublin City. And we just, like that, now developed a friendship, and it progressed. And obviously we had to keep it fairly quiet. It's not really accepted, or it wasn't back then.
Yes.
And, you know?
It wasn't encouraged back then, no.
No, Jesus, no. So there was a lot of cloak and dagger. But we met basically marching around the square and hell bowling, so we're together ever since.
Oh, that's a nice one. And when eventually it emerged that you were together, did anyone upstairs, any of the brass, start discouraging or...?
No. No, it wasn't. It kind of, I suppose it was the unseen. It was kind of, yeah, we know you're together, just don't be together. Do you know if that makes sense?
Gotcha. There you go. All right. Cheers, Marie. Thanks very much, Marie. And Chris, the Irish Navy was where they met, enlisted on the same day and met in basic training. Can you beat that? Francesca, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. Your story is what?
Yes, well, so I moved to Ireland about 8 years ago for a job. I was living in Italy, but I was living in the UK, and I got offered the job. I moved to Cork, and I kind of settled into a group of colleagues who were also going out. You know, I didn't know anybody in Cork, so, you know, I just started hanging out with the people that offered me friendship. And, you know, one of them eventually progressed from you know, colleagues, friends to going out. And then a few months later, we got engaged. And 8 years later, we're married and, you know, doing good.
Yeah. When you see workplace rules changing about, you know, flirting and sort of chatting people up, it's going to cut down on opportunities to meet people like you did, doesn't it?
It really would. I mean, I'm in favor of there being a little bit of regulations just in the way that people are allowed to interact with each other, because people can get, and I'm talking about all genders here, like people can be a little inappropriate perhaps, and it's a work setting. You want people to stay professional. And look, I was 30 when I moved for that job, and it's not like we were sneaking around like teenagers, you know, like making out in the alleyways or anything, you know. We just, you know, we were colleagues and we were friendly at work, and anything that we wanted to happened way outside of work, you know, in our own time. But it would have been really hard for me to just meet somebody. It was shift work that I was doing at the time.
And moreover, you weren't a local, you weren't a native, and you were kind of, it was the way to meet someone was to work next to them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how adults would really meet people unless they're just out all the time or they're young enough to go on Tinder or whatnot. And that's, you know, that's not my generation anymore anyway.
No, this internet thing is, I don't know, it's a whole new, this meeting people by swiping left and swiping right.
Do you think, I wouldn't be able for it.
I wouldn't be able for it either. God, no. Francesca, lovely talking to you. Arrivederci. 1850-715-996. There's a bit of crash across the road from Dino's in Blackpool. Delays in the area. City-bound. That's the inbound carriageway in towards the city across from Dino's in Blackpool. Bit of a crash there. Hope there's no one hurt. Delays in the area. Mags. Well, you wouldn't be the first and you wouldn't be the last. Mags met her husband 14 years ago in Mangans. She was legless. Was it he or she was legless? Was it you or her or him was legless? Or were you both legless? Anyway, he knocked over Mags' drink and offered to buy another. Spent the night talking and they've been together ever since. And how many children is it now, Mags? Is it 4 or 5? They say those kind of, the world is made up of those kind of little stories. I'm not going to tell you mine until I get a few more good listener calls. I met my missus in a similar way, Mags. A similar way. Although if you did to your husband what I did to my missus the night I met her, I'm surprised she ever agreed to even give me her phone number that night. And back then you had to give, because all landlines. What I did when I met her, the first night I met her, I'm surprised she ever gave me her phone number. 1850-715-996. Kevin says, I met my missus in work, a job I wasn't even going to do an interview for. They phoned and asked to confirm my appointment, so I said, Era, shag it, I may as well. Aren't you lucky you did now, Kev? 1850-715-996. Can't figure out, Mags, was it you or the husband was legless in Mangans? Because to be honest, most people were legless in Mangans anyway. 1850-715-996.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world.
Cork's 96 FM. Text the Opinion Line now. 083-396-96-96. Cork's 96 FM.
If I get one more story about meeting a partner in an unusual setting, I will tell you mine before we finish. But there's an event tonight in Carrigaline. It's in St. Mary's Church of Ireland Parish Hall in Carrigaline, involving Senator Frances Black, independent senator, and she will be speaking about Palestine and how Ireland can take action against injustice in Palestine. Now, look, the story of Palestine is a story that always engages listeners and always engages the public, because there's an affinity between the Irish people and the people of Palestine and what they have undergone at the hands of the Israeli Defence Forces for the last number of decades. And also, for example, this weekend, Sinn Féin will call, or at least one Sinn Féin TD, whose name, of course, I forgot to read, Piers Doherty, will ask his party's Ardesh to pass a motion that Ireland would boycott the Eurovision Song Contest next year because of the situation in Palestine and the fact that the contest is to be held in Jerusalem after Israel won. And of course, there's an ongoing campaign encouraging us not to buy things that come from Israel and not to do business or not to trade with companies that are based in Israel as our way of showing our disdain and showing our disapproval of what is happening to the people of Palestine. Now, on the other side, there are those, they're rare, but there are those who say, hang back a second, lads, hang back a minute. Do we really have to take everything we hear about Palestine as gospel? Maybe there are two sides to the story. Maybe there are 200 sides to the story. But Senator Francis Black will be speaking in Carrigaline tonight at St. Mary's Church of Ireland Parish. Francis, good morning.
Good morning, PJ. How are you doing?
Good, and nice to talk to you. Is this situation in Palestine, and we know it's complex, we know it's tragic, we know it's terrible, is it as simple as we make it out to be on this side of the world?
Well, PJ, I have to be totally honest with you. I was just came back there about 3 weeks ago from Palestine. I went over, I'm introducing legislation on banning goods from the illegal settlements. Yes. So I thought it would be a good idea for me to go over and see for myself the reality of the situation. And to be honest, what I saw there was beyond, just beyond my expectations. It was a million times worse than you can even imagine. Thankfully, I was able to get into Gaza, which is very hard to do, but I was very grateful to be able to get in there. And it was just devastating. I mean, it's just like an open prison. That's really what it's like, where and huge deprivation, where people can't get in and get out of Gaza. They have electricity for 2 hours a day. They don't know what time that electricity is going to be turned on at. So the farmers sometimes sleep in the fields, waiting to for the electricity to come on, or some people just have to wait at home. It's almost like they have to stay in prison themselves, waiting to see what time the electricity comes on. The water is polluted. There's no medical, no decent medical. There's over, I think it's over 50% of people are unemployed. They're aged between 18 and 24. I mean, just the hopelessness. And I sat with NGOs and I sat around the table and they were pleading with me, saying, why are the international community not helping us? And that's really, really struck a chord with me. But then I went over to the West Bank, and what I saw there was as bad, in the sense that it's an apartheid regime, really, because the West Bank is where the Palestinians should have their own land. And I got to tour the settlements that Israel has established in the occupied West Bank, and I just see how they're robbing the Palestinian farmers and families of their livelihoods. And in the past 50 years, over 40% of the West Bank has been seized. And this is making Palestinian state almost impossible. And huge farms and quarries are set up to take natural resources from the Palestinian people. Mm. And that's what we're seeing here. And I actually did a Breaking the Silence tour, which is a group of ex-Israeli soldiers who are really now, they saw themselves the injustice and have set up this organization.
I spoke to one of them a number of years ago, actually. I spoke to
Yehuda,
that's the man. Yeah.
And you know what he told me, PJ? And this really impacted me, because we were in Hebron, where he worked. And when he was there, and I'm sure he might have told you this, but this really struck a chord with me, that he told me that they were told, this is the importance of what they were meant to do. It's making their presence felt. So you might say, what does that mean? So what does that mean for the Israeli army? So that means that at 12 o'clock at night, when they would start their shift, they would go around the neighborhoods and just pick random houses, family homes, kick in the doors, terrorize the people in there, just to make their presence felt. And I could feel that even the day I was there. And they would do that from 12 o'clock in the night to 8 o'clock in the morning, because they were bored. But also, you know, when they were shooting people, it was almost like video games. It's like they don't think of it as humans. So, I mean, that's what I saw, and I'm not exaggerating. I was just appalled, and that's why this legislation that I'm bringing in.
Explain what that is.
So
it's
important.
Called the Occupied Territories Bill 2018. What is it, Francis?
Yes. So
what it is, PJ, is it seeks to ban goods produced in the illegal settlements. So we know that the settlements in the West Bank are illegal. They're moving in, they're building these big, big, beautiful neighbourhoods. And what they're doing is they're demolishing the houses of the Palestinian people and building these beautiful homes where the neighbourhoods where there's beautiful fountains and there's big shopping centres and theatres, and that's for only the Israeli people. And then you go down the road and you go in, you drive in then to where the Palestinian people live, and it's just pure deprivation where they have no water and very little electricity. So what we're trying to do is to ban goods from these illegal settlements.
What kind of goods, like, say? What kind of everyday goods are we talking about?
Well, what they do is, obviously, there's different types. There's mainly fruit, vegetables, oranges, dates, herbs, avocados, potatoes, extremely valuable beauty products from Mahava Cosmetics, which are produced, again, on stolen land in the Dead Sea, and also Keter Garden furniture in Woody's, that they sell in Woody's in the past, and they have sold those in the past. And then all these goods contribute to the injustice, and we shouldn't be supporting them. This is not the same as BDS, so I just wanted to be clear on that. And what BDS is to boycott divestment and sanctions from the whole of Israel. That's not what this is. This is just about banning goods from the illegal settlements. So it's like when we receive those goods, we're receiving stolen goods. That's what we're doing. And that's why this legislation is really important, and I've been invited down by Reverend Elaine Murray to speak tonight in Carrickaline, and I would urge people to come and support, to come and listen even to what's going on over there, but also to urge people to try and send, you know, letters to their local TDs and senators to support this legislation, mm-hmm. because it is only a small step you know, towards helping the Palestinian people. But the message that it would send to them, that Ireland care about what's going on and the injustice that's going on, would be just fantastic.
Talk to me about what Simon Coveney said. He said in the Shannon, didn't he, that he agreed that the settlements in the Palestinian, that it was unjust, that the settlements were unjust. But on the other hand, the government is going to oppose your bill. Now, balance those for me in your head if you can.
I think what Simon Coveney is more or less saying, that Ireland shouldn't lead on this, that it has to be an EU, that the whole of the EU need to lead on this. And I don't agree with that, PJ. I think it's time for Ireland to show leadership on this. You know, for decades we've done nothing but condemn what's happening, but unless there's some actual consequences, nothing will change. And as long as the settlements are profitable, and as long as we keep buying their stolen goods, they're going to continue to expand, and that's the reality. And, you know, if we can't get agreement at the EU level, it's up to individual countries to show leadership, and I think that's what's really important. And, you know, I think Simon is a very good man, in fairness to him, and I know he is passionate about this, he probably feels under pressure from the EU, and also maybe from America. But I do know that also Micheál Martin has been very good on the Palestinian issue down through the years, and Fianna Fáil have been very good. And I'm hoping with all my heart that they're going to support this legislation because of their own, I suppose, support down through the years and what they've done. They've been very involved in the recognition in Palestine, in that motion. So I'm hoping that Fianna Fáil will support us on this. And again, I would urge people to get on to their local Fianna Fáil representative as well as Fine Gael. We have all of the other people. We've all the independents. We have the Labour Party. We have Sinn Féin supporting this legislation. All we need now is Fianna Fáil, really. And I do think, as I say, that Micheál Martin also has a good heart, as well as Simon Coveney. I understand that Simon Coveney is under pressure, but, you know, I do really feel it would be fantastic if Fianna Fáil would support this legislation.
What about this call, Francis, from Sinn Féin, Piers Doherty, will try to get a motion passed at their Ardèche this weekend in Belfast, that Ireland would not, or that RTE would not send a delegation to the Eurovision Song Contest in 2019?
I would have to agree with it, and I know that Charlie McGettigan
that the Eurovision was the one that came on the following day after the Eurovision. He was on, I think, Joe Duffy or one of those radio shows. And he said that we have to boycott it. And I would agree with that. I think we have to do something to show support and solidarity to the Palestinian people, because what's going on over there? When I sat with the NGOs in Gaza, they said, we thought it would never, when the war happened in 2014 and they were getting bombed, they thought nothing will ever be as bad as that. But it's actually getting worse and worse and worse. And the terror that they're living under is just horrendous. And that feeling, to watch the Palestinian people not be able to walk down their own street in their own land, because, and that's an apartheid regime we're talking about here, but to watch them, the army stopping them because there's an Israeli family living in a huge big neighborhood. You know, the place is almost like a ghost town because there's so many Israeli families living there. They're not allowed to walk down their own roads. I mean, it's just awful. It's just awful. And you see the terror that they... It's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking. So I really do believe, yes, I believe that we should boycott the Eurovision next year. And certainly I will be supporting whatever campaign is out there. I'll be supporting it.
Your event is on tonight at St Mary's Church of Ireland Parish Hall in Carrigaline at 8:30. Senator Francis Black, thanks for that. Ken is our regular man who calls the show and talks to us about Palestine, because in fairness, Ken, your knowledge of the area is vast. Francis has Bill the idea that we would boycott stuff coming from the occupied areas and not necessarily Israel as a general country. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, I'd agree with it, because like she's saying, they're like, we need action, not words. Like, I think I support BDS, which is to target all of Israel, but look, I wouldn't complain about targeted sanctions, because all we're getting these days is words and no actions at all. You know?
Like, if I was to support BDS now, for argument's sake, what would I not buy? I mean, you see, people say, okay, what would I... If I was in Tesco's or I was in Supervalue today and I was doing a bit of shopping and I was supporting BDS, what would I not buy?
Well, anything from Israel, which, like, from the illegal settlements, most of it is, like, fruit and veg and stuff like that, like spuds. As I said earlier, they have products from the Dead Sea, which is occupied land, so it's all like these beauty products and stuff like that. But see, that's different to BDS. BDS is actually, it's about like the target banks, universities, you know, like UCC now wouldn't, say, send people over to Israel, and they wouldn't accept people from Israel over there. But the illegal, like most people would, I think, support not buying goods from the illegal settlements, you know, and I think that's a start anyway, because there is absolutely nothing happening. It's just ongoing, like Francis said there, it's every day now, and there's no action being done, like, and that emboldens Israel, because if Israel keeps getting away with stuff, they're going to keep doing it, you know?
I mentioned in my introduction, Ken, that we have a tendency, I suppose because of our own history, we tend to accept as black and white gospel everything that comes out on the Palestinian side of the argument. And there's a tendency, or at least we're encouraged to think, that every word coming from the mouths of the Israelis is a lie. Is that a fair stance to take?
It's not, no. Because, look, there's no doubt Hamas are capable of lying just as much as the Israelis are. You know, but I think it's always about looking at the bigger picture of what's the root cause of the problem. You know, like, obviously, like, I don't just listen to Palestinians and ignore Israelis. I interact with Israelis all the time. You know, it's important. And again, it's important to know that, like, the Jews of Israel, they deserve to have peace and security just as much as the Palestinians do. But it can't be at the expense of the Palestinians, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that's the important thing is, like, I don't think you're saying that the Jews or the Israelis can't live there. It's just that the situation at the moment can't go on the way it is. You're going to have stories on different days where lies are going to come out, but it's always important to look at the root cause of the problem.
Like, I spoke to a military man who spent time, retired now, spent time living in there, living in that neck of the woods, working with the UN, and he lived in Gaza, and he lived in Jerusalem, and he lived in Damascus as well for a time. And he said, be very careful who you believe on any given day of the week.
You have to, because look, there's no doubt, like, you get propaganda from Hamas and all that. Look, they are what they are, you know what I mean? But the same as I wouldn't judge all Israelis by the the crazy settlers or the army. You need to do the same with Palestinians, you know. So you have to be careful. I have people that I talk to in Gaza, and I know they only put out fact, and they'll tell you who's lying and stuff like that, like, you know.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt. You know Hamas. Hamas are a dangerous group. They're going to lie. They're going to do anything they can to make Israel look bad. But if you were to take away Hamas tomorrow, the problem would still be the same. Nothing would change. I think that's the main point, you know.
Fair enough. All right, Ken, thank you very much. 1850 715 996. The man who told us about Francis Black coming to Carrigaline is Padraig Fitzgerald from the Kinsale Peace Project. And a few years, Padraig, good morning. A few years ago, it was you introduced me to that ex-Israeli soldier as well.
That's right, indeed. Yehuda Shaul was our Peace Project guest here over 2 years ago.
Fascinating man.
And a man who lives in Jerusalem and, you know, goes to the local schools in his area, you know, to educating people on what exactly does happen and what did happen when they were conscripted. Remember, all 18-year-olds in Israel are all conscripted to the army for 3 years. And
that, is it three? That, I thought it was only two.
Maybe two, apologies. But it's serious. You know, everyone's taken out of college or school and they're forced into the army and they can't escape that. And that's another issue for another day. I think that adds to the whole situation in that particular area. But Yehuda, frankly, spoke about the situation there when they were Israeli, when he was in the Israeli army in occupied Palestine, and the, I suppose, the psychological bullying and muscle that the Israeli Defense Forces are allowed to do. You know, Israel is a big conglomerate, if you wish, English-speaking, American-sounding PR. You know, you hear them on the radio and TV. And like your previous speaker, who was excellent in explaining the situation, you have to read a bit deeper into everybody's message, just like fake news in the media.
Yeah, I was advised, and I intend to sit down and read it across the summer. There's a great book called by James Michener called The Source, which is a very, very fat novel. But it's written by a man who had to study the history, and I was told it's a very good way to learn the history through a novel.
That's right. It is. The novels are definitely... Now, I've read a few books over the years, and to be honest with you, I'm not a historian, but it's taken me about 10 years to kind of go back nearly as far as the Crusades to, you know, about Jerusalem and so forth. But I think what most people do, you know, to get a bit more interested in the subject, because it has relevance to us here in Ireland and the Troubles, there's a parallel there. And it, you know, today people need to hear the real story of the ordinary Palestinian people who have very little to live for. Indeed, as I sit here in my office in Kinsale, I'm looking out at the fishing fleet. If they were only allowed to fish 6 miles out to sea, and if they went further than that, they were shot at by Israeli defense forces. I mean, that would cause uproar. You know what I'm just saying?
They're not allowed.
That's what's happening. Economic squeezing in a tiny spot. They can't trade. You know, it's very difficult to trade with the outside world. Trade and education is what I believe is the way forward for these places, to give teenagers, you know, otherwise if there's massive unemployment, you know what's going to happen? They're going to possibly end up joining a wrong sort of group and throwing stones at Israeli tanks and, you know, getting shot at, you know, body counts mounting up. And I think, you know, through EU funding and different groups like France's and us all trying to bring awareness to the subject
and
in
I
daily life.
Take it finally, you believe that we should not enter Eurovision next year?
Personally, at Jerusalem, I think the latest situation when President Trump allowed his embassy to be open with his family members in Jerusalem was an insult to the Palestinian people. It infuriated the situation, and as you could see from the headlines, it made a bad situation worse and accounted for, you know, endless deaths of even a nurse, a medic. She was 21. She was shot, you know, clearly medic written across her in white, you know, and educated. You know, a lot of these people are trying to do their best. They live under extreme circumstances that, you know, that their colleges are bombed time and time again, and very little economic support. And we all know Israel has huge, huge economic support from their friends, the US, and more than ever now from President Trump and his
well, I won't say it on air what I think about his department.
Probably
and family
best
members.
Not. But should Maybe we finally, yet. should we go to Eurovision next year?
No, as Francis said there and Charlie McGettigan, I think it's a form of apartheid. And I think, as we know ourselves, via the Dunstores workers there in the 80s, apartheid South Africa, I think we should make a stand, you know, cause a ripple in the overall ocean. But, you know, those people, you know, different ripples can result in an outcome in not immediately, but, you know, the world can take note that somewhere like Ireland can do something on a human scale to help these unfortunate people who have very little to live and work for.
All right. Yeah. Padraig, it's good to talk to you. Padraig Fitzgerald from the Kinsale Peace Process Project. That event tonight with Francis Black is at the St. Mary's Church of Ireland Parish Hall in Carrigaline, starting at around 8:30. 1850 715 996. Dan also recommends a book called A Line in the Sand by James Barr. There's a 3-car crash outside Commons Road at the entrance to Blackpool Shopping Centre. Hopefully nothing too serious.
The Opinion Line with the Ireland edition of The Times. Be well informed on Ireland and the world.
Cork's 96 FM. Call The Opinion Line now. 1850 715 996. Cork's 96 FM.
Kevin, I know you're going to tell us your story about how you met your missus, but first of all, you wanted to mention something to do with Palestine.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with the Sinn Féin motion with RT not televising, I don't think we're going to be alone in that. I have a funny feeling that the Netherlands are looking at something similar by not sending someone. I can definitely see that one growing legs.
Mm.
And people take a stand, especially if things carry on the way it's going, and with Israel and the... you had the case with the medic that was shot in the head last week.
That's right.
You know, these snipers aren't fools. They know
what they're hitting. That wasn't an accident. They know what they're
hitting. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, they're breaking UN law by targeting medics that are clearly identifiable as medics. You know, what's next? Yeah. Well, someone has to draw a line. America isn't going to do it. We've seen that already. And even if it's only a symbolic gesture,
yeah.
I mean, what else can you do? You know, you really
It will be a strong gesture when you can.
It would do, because the world watches. You know, you look what happened with China when they said they weren't going to show it. That made global news. You know, and that was because the EU or the EBU decided to pull the plug on China hosting it. You know, what would happen if 4 or 5 European countries decided, no, we're not sending anyone this year?
Yeah.
You know, it would get picked up, it would get noticed.
It would. Very quickly, how did you meet herself?
Well, it's funny enough, I was gone for a job, and I was going back to college, and I was going to take a part-time job. I wasn't going to take this one, but they phoned me and asked me to go for an interview anyway. So I went, got interviewed, got the job, went for our induction. I was sat in a chair with a group of about 4 of us, and along she comes, "You're sat in my seat." "No, I'm not." So I said, "Come sit down here." So she sat in my lap, and away we go. You know, and it was as simple as that. It was 23 years ago. I wasn't giving up the seat, and because it was closest to the door and closest to the bar. And it was working in a restaurant, and we all had drinks on the table, and I wasn't giving up my seat. So she said, "Move over, and I'll sit." And she sat down in my lap. Yeah, you know, I just thought, you know what?
If you did that nowadays...
Well, the thing is...
You'd be lifted out of it.
You would, but in fairness, I loved the fact that she was confident enough to say, "It's not you. Who the hell do you think you are, like?" And plucked herself down in my lap, and we had a great night.
Well, I'll tell you my story while you're there. So I said if I get one more, I would. I was DJ at a 21st birthday party in Chandra's back in the day. And it was a Monday night, and I had no mind to be there because I'd been out for the few pints with the boys on Sunday night, and I was still recovering a bit. And Monday night, sat in to play a few tunes for a 21st birthday party, and this woman came up to me, young woman came up to me, and she started asking me about playing Prince and asking me to play George Michael, and started feeding straight into my taste in music. So I started playing the music, and she started talking to me, and we. Next thing you know, comes the food break in the 21st. So she says, "Come on, I'll buy you a pint for playing all that music." So out she went, and I was very partial to a pint of Guinness at the time, so she bought me a pint of Guinness. She was wearing a white dress, and I promptly spilled the damn pint right down the front of the dress.
If you're going to do it in style. You should have told her that if you bought me Beamish, I'd have minded it better.
Go on, Kev. Thanks, man. Cheers. Bye. 1850 715 996. I met my future hubby in Bolivia in South America. I'm from the UK, and he's a Cork man. We were having a few drinks and Bob's your uncle fell head over heels. Once we finished travelling, we commuted for a while. Then he moved over to Cork. He's a doctor and I'm a nurse. Hey, listen, how well fitted is that? My beloved asked me out and I said, no, I can't. I'm going to bingo with me ma'am. He wasn't impressed, but he asked me when I could go out next. So the next night we went out and 25 years later, we're still together. Says Elizabeth, 1850-715-996. Good stories to end the week. It's been a busy one. The programme today edited by Fergal Barry, produced and researched by Shirley Donovan. Your podcast up, remember, a little bit later on a Friday, a little bit later, around evening time, repeat in the early hours of Sunday. Have a good weekend. We see you Monday morning, just after 9.